call the Civil Law Committee to order. Quorum is now present. Members, just a few housekeeping items, first of all, and then a couple announcements. Let's first move the minutes. There's a correction to the 1:31:11 minutes. There was a change in who was absent and who was present that we had to revise. It's corrected copy is in your packet. Representative Druskowski, you want to move the corrected minutes from 1:31:11?
Mr. Chair, I do move the corrected minutes from 1:31:11.
Any discussion to the correction? Otherwise, we'll approve the corrected minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. The other minutes are from 2:07:11, yesterday's meeting. Is there any comments, discussion on those minutes? Otherwise, the chair will move the approval of the 2:07:11 minutes. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Members, tonight we've got the one bill, House File 322 by Representative Scott. We've set aside 90 minutes for both sides, and we want to keep methodical in our process, letting people voice their concerns. We know this is a very concerning issue to many people. Emotions can run high, and so to the audience as well, I want you to know we want to keep order in this room tonight. We want to have everybody respected and be able to be heard. The sergeant's office is around. They'll be checking in, and we don't want to disrespect anybody, and so I'm going to be asking everybody to withhold any applause, any sighs, any agreement or disagreement to what somebody might say. Please show that respect for everybody. No signs, and so those are just some of the rules. Getting back to an issue that was arose about 10 days ago with videotaping in this room. I've talked with the sergeant's office, and the issue and the policy that they have is videotaping is allowed so long as it is not disruptive to the committee or photography or media. And so so long as it's not disruptive or distractive to the members, it is allowed, but please be courteous if you choose to do that and follow that policy as well. So Representative Hillstrom, you have a comment or question?
I have a question, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, is it your intention to take the testimony and then vote the bill out this evening or have the vote on the bill this evening, or are you planning to have testimony today and then discussion and or discussion later and a vote later? I'm just trying to get a sense of, after 90 minutes on each side, what happens next.
Representative Hillstrom, my intention is we won't take a vote on the bill tonight. I would like to have 90 minutes on both sides. So somewhere around a little after 9 o'clock, we would conclude tonight, and next Monday probably finish up with discussion from the committee members and have a vote. I anticipate next Monday at this point in time.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so are all the amendments on the bill present here, or do you anticipate then on Monday that there would be additional amendments that would be presented based on today's testimony?
I don't anticipate any others, but I might not be the best one to ask that. The ones that are out are all we had by 3 o'clock today. Maybe it'd be a good question for the author, or she might be able to address it, or if other members have it. I'm not aware of any, and so that's the most I can tell you at this point.
Mr. Chair.
Members, we are also being recorded live tonight. and streamed over the website, and it will be on TV. So just a reminder to the witnesses and to the members, use your microphones so it picks up for the listening public if they're not here as well. And so Representative Hillstrom, just with what you brought up, I also would like members to try to stay, and just because we're not voting, it's still we would like to have as many people that can stay as possible. So with no further ado, let's move on with the evening. Everybody has important things to get home for, and Representative Scott, we'll have you come and present your bill. Am I just too close to this? We're going to give you 90 minutes. I understand you have several parties that are interested in testifying. I'm going to ask if you can, they can work and organize together. When you get down to 30 minutes, I will try to give you a warning, and then a couple thereafter, and so people can manage their time and testimony. Mm-hmm. We want to be fair to both sides, mm-hmm. and so we'll start your 90 minutes once you've had a chance to get to the table and proceed with your bill. Representative Scott will first move the passage of House File 322, and refer it to the Judiciary Committee. And I understand, Representative Scott, you have a couple author's amendments to get the bill in the shape you would like it.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do. Thank you. Thank you for everyone coming out here this evening, both on the committee and in the audience. I appreciate everyone's participation in this evening.
Representative Scott, should we move? Why don't I move the amendments so we get the bill in the shape the author is in, presumably the way people will bring forth their discussion.
Okay.
The author of the bill, Representative Scott, would move the A2 amendment. Any discussion to that? Representative Scott, just briefly, what's the A2 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is mostly a technical amendment. It just changes a few words in the body of the bill, mostly on pages 4 and pages 6, page 4 and 6. And I think it's pretty self-explanatory. I don't know if anyone else needs any more explanation. Hopefully everyone's had a chance to.
Any questions? Otherwise, to get it in the shape the author desires, all those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. The Representative Scott moves the A3 amendment. Briefly, what does that do, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, this we added a paragraph that defines what shared parenting is, and we felt that was necessary for clarification. Makes the bill a little more easily understood as to what that term means. Also, we added a paragraph in subdivision 5A, and that basically is very similar to the notice sections that you see within the bill on pages 4 and 6, but we wanted to put it elsewhere in the bill as those notices aren't necessarily part of law, so we wanted to make sure that that language is included in the body of the bill. The other thing that we changed this to is in this paragraph is to make the bill a little bit more flexible. And what we did there is we articulated the fact that if two parents come up with a parenting plan and it's for less than 45%, 45.1% on behalf of one of the other parents, that's acceptable if both parties sign off on it, and that child support would be adjusted accordingly.
Okay. Any discussion on the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Scott, now the bill is in the shape the author would prefer, and go ahead and present your bill. We'll start the 90 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure most of you sitting around this table have known a family member or friend who has experienced a custody battle over children of a divorced or an unmarried or of unmarried parents. I say battle because that is what the process has become, a contest to determine who is the better parent. The grand prize is to be the custodial parent. The loser in this case is not only the non-custodial parent, who many times has been used to having daily contact with their child, sharing meals, helping with homework, playing, same bedtime prayers, etc. But the biggest loser in these instances where both parents are fit parents are the children. The evidence is clear and the research is voluminous that outcomes for children are best when maximizing a child's time with both parents. Because of the custodial parent, non-custodial parent model, many children are being deprived of this essential time with each parent. The results are issues such as teen pregnancy, teen suicide, poor grades, and gang involvement. The courts, according to statute, are supposed to allow a minimum of 25% parenting time. As you will hear from one of our witnesses this evening, who conducted a 7-county study here in the state of Minnesota of custody files and divorce files, the custodial parent, usually the father, is getting even less time than that. How many of you who have children in their homes right now would think it fair that you are suddenly told that you may now see your child 4 nights a month and a few hours every Wednesday evening? How many children benefit from that arrangement? The objective of this bill is to equalize as much as possible the amount of time a child interacts with both parents. We've been working with those on both sides of this issue and are committed to making the bill be the best that it can be for the children of Minnesota. I truly hope that at the end of the day that the kids are the winner. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to invite, if possible, Mr. Chair, Molly Olson to the table.
That's fine, Representative Scott. If Molly and then any others that you know in the order that you want after that, please just have them ready and they can come up and introduce themselves for the record. Ms. Olson? Molly Olson, welcome to our committee, and if you can just identify yourself for the record, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, for being here this evening for this very important topic. My name is Molly Olson, and I am the founder and volunteer executive director of the Center for Parental Responsibility, an organization that was developed to mobilize citizens interested in children and knowledgeable about and experienced in all of the problems that occur in family court. Throughout these years in this organization, we have had many volunteers who ebb and flow throughout our organization, as with any volunteer group. But one thing has remained. There's been a consistent thread in the last 12 years that there are problems that continue to persist in family court, which are creating, really, unnecessary court-forced fatherlessness. And that's what we're here tonight to try to change. With this bill, what we really want to do, in the spirit of celebrating tolerance and diversity, the aim is to give the child, every child, the opportunity to gain the full benefits that each fit, loving parent has to offer. We want to take away the fight. We want to create an expectation of equality, not the current win-lose model that exists in our law. For those that are teachers or no teachers, we know that in the school systems, the teachers have learned that if you expect a child to succeed, they are more likely to succeed. And the same we want to be true, and we want to be able to see in family court. With this bill, we want to reduce litigation, not only for our courts to save court costs, but also for the individual families that are being really pulverized by this system financially. We want to move away from litigation and move towards cooperation. We want to, number four, we want to keep both parents involved in a child's life and reduce this fatherlessness because of the well-documented negative impact on kids when there is no father in their lives. Five, we want to make a strong statement towards the cultural shift that needs to take place to ensure a child's right to both fit parents and the value of each of those parents, because that is taking place in our culture across the country, and it needs to also take place in our family courts in every county, in every district in this state. Six, the law should not get in the way when a fit, loving parent is ready, willing, and able to take their responsibility and share parenting equally. And the goal for us really here is to remove the need for some of these artificial labels that have no purpose anymore in law or in implementation. We want to neutralize the fight over children. And of course, lastly, we want to make sure that all victims of domestic violence are protected. And nothing in this bill will change any of the current statutes that have been put in place to protect those individuals.
Mr. Chair, next I'd like to ask up to the testifiers table. Brian Ulrich, he's the one that did the seven-county study for us.
Okay. Mr. Ulrich, and then Paul. Jonathan Euker, that's who we've got next is on deck. Representative Scott, is that accurate?
Yeah, I'm not sure how that happened, but we'll have him go after.
Okay. That's fine. You can control the... If you got the list, you can just do it as you've got organized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I would like to take a moment to introduce Brian, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Ms. Olson.
As an organization, the Center for Parental Responsibility, as I said, we've had many volunteers ebb and flow throughout our organization as they find out about what we're trying to accomplish on the Internet. And in the fall of 2009, Brian Ulrich came to the organization with the same concern that thousands and thousands of others before him have, and that is, The family law system is very broken. What can I do to help? At that time, we were just coming off the heels of the 2009 legislative session, which heard about the Joint Physical Custody Study Group at the State Supreme Court that was legislated in the spring of 2009. And the outcome of that was that the study group determined there just wasn't enough information to know whether or not there was a problem, or even if there was a problem, or if there was a problem, what the problem was. Now, on that study group, which I have mentioned to this committee before, there were 13 people on that committee, and of those 13 people, 12 of them had gone on record as being opposed to joint physical custody and equal shared parenting. So there were just two of us on that committee that were there to talk about what is really happening and why we need change. With that said, we wanted to respect the majority of that committee and do whatever we could to provide them with the information they were seeking. Fortunately, about that time, Brian came to CPR and was willing to put in the research to manage and implement a very major project, a court file research project. And I would like Brian to tell you about that, but I'll tell you just a little bit about his background, too. He is an accountant by trade and by profession, so he's very meticulous about the details and spreadsheets and numbers, which fit very well into this project. And he has been very involved in other legal issues in the medical community, which has made him very aware of how to read statutes and how to read court orders, which put him in a very unique position for this project. And I know that we only have a short amount of time. I want to actually watch my time. We plan on about 10 minutes for Brian to review this study tonight, and we know that really ideally we need about 30 minutes to go through this, so we're only going to give you a cursory overview of what we found out, and if there's another opportunity to meet with each of you individually or in another informational kind of setting, we'd be more than happy to give you even more details. With that said, I think I'll turn it over to Brian.
Mr. Ulrich, Representative Hillstrom, you have a question?
Yes, just briefly, Mr. Chair. Are we going to get then a copy of the study results or a written-up summary, or is there some document someplace that we can look at?
Yes, knowing that the committee is going to meet again Monday, I believe I will be able to have that ready for the committee. I had computer problems this afternoon just as I was printing some of the information for you, and I intended on having that for you tonight, but with the deadline chance to get information in plenty several hours or days before this hearing that wasn't able to be done, but yes.
Members, as we go through the witnesses, I think it's probably the best if we let each witness get their statements out before we ask questions. So if you can just write down your questions, if you have one for a particular witness, and the more you can keep to the end, I think the better it is to let the witnesses move through the process. But that's how I'd like to handle questions, so we don't let's let each witness present and then go on, and we'll try to get that study to the members as soon as you could, Ms. Olson, get it to us. Mr. Ulrich, welcome to our committee. If you can identify yourself for the taped record and proceed.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. My name is Brian Ulrich. I am here as a volunteer for the Center for Parental Responsibility that Molly Olson has been running for many years at this point, in an effort toward the shared parenting. And what I'm going to do tonight is just talk briefly about how we put this study together. Molly's already given you the background on what the need for it was that came out of the joint study group. And so I'm just going to go through details, and Molly's going to add some comments here and there to the facts that I share. First of all, we laid out our approach as to, and as directed by Molly, primarily to determine what areas we could study that would provide a significant source of research on what's happening in the family law courts here in Minnesota. As many of you probably know, these family law files, once they're dispensed of with final orders, end up being placed into file cabinets at the various court offices, with the court administrators never to be touched again in most cases. There's really been no statistical data gathering on them, unlike the criminal law files, where a lot of data is gathered for public policy decisions. At any rate, we determined to set out and look at seven counties. We wanted one metropolitan county, so Ramsey County here in St. Paul was selected. We looked at several large outstate communities, including the counties of Blue Earth, which includes Mankato, County of Clay, including Moorhead, Olmsted County, which includes the city of Rochester, Stearns County, which is it has its county seat in St. Cloud, Douglas County up by Alexandria, and Polk County by Glenwood. Douglas and Polk County were included as smaller rural outstate areas to compare to the others in the group, but those are the seven counties where files were initially pulled and examined. The process of determining what we would look at was overseen by Carl Boudreau, one of the other volunteers for CPR. He was able to put together a search string that allowed us to isolate the family law files that involved disillusions with children. And from that population of data, we looked at data from January 1, 2008, for cases that were opened on or after that date until October 18th of 2009. And then all of those cases between there that had final orders issued by mid-November of 2009. So we tried to get a recent year plus of data together to be able to work from. I had a number of other volunteers that assisted that I want to mention very quickly. Neil Heinze from Mankato, Charlie Hurd from Mankato, and Tim Mahoney, as mentioned, Representative Mahoney, that we had several interns from Hamline Law School that assisted here in Ramsey County. And I was very appreciative to all of their efforts. Once Carl and I were able to identify the population of files for that period, we had the CPA firm Larson Allen Wishier, known as LawCo, pull a statistical sample. The gross number of files was almost 2,000 files for that seven county area. and they were able to narrow it down to a statistical sampling of 430 files just to help make the whole project a little more manageable. We excluded files that involved custody or unmarried parents, rather, because in paternity cases, which many of those start as, paternity case files are marked as confidential and are not open to the public. So once paternity is established, if a party commences a custody proceeding, the way the court administrator offices handle that is to combine all of that activity into the paternity file. So all of that becomes confidential information. So there's far fewer than expected, than what we expected to see, custody files open to the public for non-married parents. So again, we restricted the study to simply disillusions with children. Just to quickly go through some of the key findings, and again, Molly will interject here on some of this. First of all, the divorce orders reflect that mom files for divorce over 70% of the time when there are children involved in the case. We did some sampling of files without children involved, divorces without kids, and found that the gender was pretty equally balanced between male and female parties filing those cases. Another significant finding, the divorce orders reflect the recognition of the presumption of joint legal custody, which, as you know, is laid out in the Minnesota statutes. We did adjust our data for what we call outliers. Those involve cases where a parent is incarcerated, has moved either out of the country or quite a distance away from the other parent and children, or where they were unresponsive to the disillusion process. And the overall totals, 99% after adjustment of the mothers had legal custody, and 95% in total of the dads had legal custody. So that is clearly being implemented as the statutes outline. Another finding, the divorce orders reflect that moms have physical custody label more than twice as often as dads. I've heard some of the prior committee hearings off the internet, and I know that this whole business about the physical custody and how it's primarily a label, but I wanted to talk about that just real briefly. The law defines joint physical custody as a structuring of parenting time between the two parents. It doesn't define it as being equal as it does in the legal custody area. And so a lot of files, frankly, are mislabeled and refer to sole physical custody for the mother, when in fact the actual structuring of the parenting time is split between the parents, and they really are joint physical custody files as the statutes define them, as the statutes define the term physical custody. Another finding, the divorce orders reflect that moms have attorneys nearly twice as often as dads. And that's consistent with the qualitative data that Molly has gathered over the years from parents who go through the system. Dads are unrepresented in these cases roughly two-thirds of the time. And I think that's a significant statistic for the committee to be aware of. Molly might want to add just a couple comments to that.
Well, one of the issues that we find, and we have heard that the courts recognize that there's more and more pro se litigants, that fewer and fewer have attorneys, and this is reflected in this information as well, showing that fathers by far have less attorneys. And in the information throughout the last 12 years that I've been involved in this, since 2003 when CPR started, what I've learned through fathers and then doing some of my own research, just phone calls, and also is that there are quite a few resources out there for mothers who need attorneys when they are low income or can't afford an attorney like everybody else, but there are almost zero. There's one that used to be available in Minneapolis, but almost zero free or sliding fee scale attorneys that will or organizations that will take these kind of cases on behalf of fathers. And that, I think, is part of the reason why we see this.
The next finding to discuss is to share is the divorce orders reflect that judges are deciding cases only about 1% of the time. And you previously heard from Nancy, a vice dean at William Mitchell College of Law, that their number showed about 5% of cases decided by judges. Our statistics represent about or show 1% of cases decided by judges. Another finding is that the divorce orders reflect that the parties are using formal mediation to arrive at their agreements only about 2% of the time across all the files studied. Do you have anything you want to mention on that, Molly? Or
I think that what this says is that formal mediation is something that very few people probably even know about. They don't know it exists, they don't know how it works, and they don't even know how to get a mediator or other kinds of alternative dispute resolution.
Okay, going on to our last two points to highlight here. Another finding, the divorce orders reflect that parties are reaching agreement through attorneys or otherwise without outside the court process in 72% of the cases. That does not include cases heard as default. Default proceedings average about 15% of the cases, and the default cases involve situations where one parent has agreed with the other for just the one parent to proceed with the filing and through the process on their own. So in other words, there's an agreement that made in advance, and then secondly includes cases where parties were totally absent from the process. So over 90% of the cases involve either agreements or default proceedings. And then lastly, one of the key findings is that divorce orders reflect that dads are sharing parenting time at 45% or more in roughly 44% of the cases. Again, we adjusted here for outliers where a dad was incarcerated, moved out of the country, was a far distance away. We took those cases out of the statistics. In nearly two-thirds of the cases, dads have at least 30% parenting time, and that's an overall statistic across all the files. And I think at this point I'll turn it over to Molly to conclude our comments.
This particular finding, I think, is worthy of quite a bit more discussion, maybe at a later time in a different sort of venue. But what has happened here is, after many lengthy court battles, very expensive court battles, and a lot of litigation, people are ending up with parenting time, finally concluding that when they've run out of money, that maybe equal shared parenting is the best thing to do once they finally run out of money. But if we can help reduce that litigation and get people to the outcome faster, it's going to benefit children, because when there's litigation, there's conflict, and conflict is what's bad for children. And also, still, we have a very significant amount of cases that are getting 25% or less parenting time when, according to statute, it's been 25%. So there's a lot of education and a lot of issues and a lot of awareness building that needs to be done. And the bill that Peggy has incorporates some of that. as we will be including the language in the orders that are already in the informational orders and the notices that are already going out from the court to let the parents know. And keep in mind that this is for divorce orders. We, as Brian mentioned earlier, one of the reasons we selected the divorce orders versus the paternity and the ROP's recognition of parentage, the never married, is because we anticipated a higher percent of involvement with the parents of divorce. And what we found anecdotally in this process is that many of the judges out there don't even think that the presumption applies to never married parents, even though the U.S. Supreme Court and the Minnesota state law says that all parents are treated equally. There's a lot more information we could share with you. We've already gone to our 15 minutes for this particular segment, which we had planned. We can answer any questions now, or if we prefer to go through and hold them until the end.
Representative Hillstrom has a question, and then I think we'll move to your next witness.
Mr. Chair, I just want the appropriate time to ask questions about the study, because I do have a few questions about, for example, what percentage of the files were mislabeled, as you spoke about. What numbers of these files actually are the lengthy court battles that you've spoken about, and what number were 25% or less time that was order of the files that you studied?
Should we proceed with that?
Well, you tell me. I'm thinking you might have enough witnesses to use up the last hour and 5 or 10
minutes. We do. Representative West, Chair Westrom and Representative Hillstrom, we do have and do have that information readily available, and I would like to get that to you, and possibly we could even meet individually and where I can provide that to you quickly, and then after the session or sometime during the day, and then possibly even Monday.
And Mr. Chair, I'm happy to ask those questions during our discussion time, but I think that if arguments are made based on these stated facts, I think we should know what the factual numbers are on the record.
Sure. Well, and I think you've got the information, the question. I think that's a little more in-depth to answer than a brief one right now, Representative Hillstrom, so why don't we get the answers a little bit later.
That's fine, Mr. Chair.
Jonathan Uecker. Is that next one you have, Representative Scott?
Yes, Mr. Chair, he's coming forward now.
Mr. Uecker, welcome to the Civil Law Committee. If you can identify yourself for our record.
My name is Jonathan Uecker. I'm a board-certified psychiatrist. I've been practicing here in Minnesota for about 20 years. I'm here representing only my opinions. I'm not here representing the opinions of the Minnesota Psychiatric Society or the Minnesota Medical Association tonight. When you look at this issue, you know, one of the first things you do as a doctor is you try to look at the scientific literature for guidance on this, and it's very conflictual area because of many of the studies are promoted or slanted by various women's groups or father's rights groups, so it's hard to find studies that don't appear to have some bias. And many of the studies are small, and they don't look at outcomes over a number of years. What I did walk away from when I looked at this, the medical or scientific or social science literature on this area, is that it appears that greater father involvement or paternal involvement does promote better compliance with those dads paying their child support. And for the kids, it appears that there is improved performance in school, lower rates of dropping out of school, lower rates of suicide, psychiatric hospitalization, drug use, incarceration later on in life, and running away from home. And kind of my thought is that these are things that would possibly help with our human services budget down the road. I believe one of the best studies was done by a guy named Robert Busserman in 2002, where he actually looked at 33 other studies, what we call a meta-analysis. And it was pretty clear from this study that he saw better adjustment in children, and this was family relationships, self-esteem, behavior problems, and adjustment to the divorce itself when there was joint physical and legal custody rather than in sole custody settings. Another study that I thought was good because it was such a large study was done in 1998 by Setzer at the U of Wisconsin. It involved 13,000 families. And in this study, her conclusion was that in controlling for the quality of family relationships before the separation and looking at socioeconomic status, that it had appeared that fathers with joint custody saw their kids more, they had more overnight visits. Again, they were more likely to pay their child support than in situations where mothers had sole legal custody. And another interesting conclusion that she came to is that the level of conflict before separation appeared to have no impact on the outcome, providing some evidence that it was not just simply more cooperative parents who were choosing the joint custody. And she proposes that there is a shift in thinking from whether fathers will be involved to how they would be involved as partly responsible for her findings. Now, with my personal thoughts on this, it seems, and again, I've seen, I guess, many cases where you see both good and bad outcomes, but what I think about when I think about this situation is that I see a number of adult patients who when you take an abuse or childhood history, often indicate that their parents' divorce was one of the most traumatic things that happened to them. And when you talk to a lot of these, they're adults now, one of the things that they feel is that they not only had to deal with the stress of their parents' divorce, but also the loss of one of their parents. And it's not uncommon to say that this was worsened by the fact, and this is a direct quote, that I hardly ever saw my father again. And one of the things we know in the mental health literature is that there is a strong correlation between parental loss and higher rates of depression during adulthood. Another thought that comes to mind is that I treat a number of single parents. Most of them are mothers, but there's also some fathers. And these individuals often have very little or no help from an ex-spouse or an ex-partner. Sometimes that's not possible, and in some cases it's probably a good thing that there is an involvement because that other parent is not able to parent. But what I've noticed with these individuals is that it is very stressful being on call 24 hours a day for two or three kids when you don't get any help. And this often leads to worsening depression, and it makes it also harder for them to parent their kids. And I guess I just wonder if there were ways to promote greater involvement by fathers. And I also wonder if our current law and our current culture has almost created this mindset or a zeitgeist, especially for fathers, that you're not really not important, and therefore you don't have to be involved. Again, I think it would be helpful if we could promote policies that would change that. I guess kind of my thoughts on this is it seems like under the current law, it's fathers who must ask for joint custody and it's mother's decision to agree or disagree. And aside for those minority cases where there is child abuse or spousal abuse or serious drug or alcohol problems or mental health issues, it seems like a fair point would be that both parents start with the presumption that they would have equal time with their children. And I guess my personal feeling is that that would inherently create less conflict and antagonism. When I talk to my colleagues in mental health, there needs to be room for flexibility working from there because there's just so many permutations of what's going to be best for everybody, especially for the kids. Under the current system, I'll have to tell you, many of my colleagues avoid getting involved with child custody issues like the plague. We hear it, we run. I've even heard of situations where people have done an interview and said, I can't help you, you'll have to see someone else. Basically, because these cases are so contentious, and it is my understanding that one of the main reasons why social workers and psychologists are reported to their prospective boards is because one of the parties in these cases was unhappy with the recommendations. It also seems, I guess, that our current situation with divorced parents is somewhat at odds with our policies and laws regarding child protection. It seems like with child protection, the policies are very much geared towards keeping kids with their biological parents. And what I guess I've seen is that, parents are often given multiple chances to improve and to change their behavior before their parental rights are eventually terminated. And it seems like in divorce cases, this basically can happen, that the parental rights can be terminated de facto because one spouse is simply angry with the other. Now, again, there's going to always be those situations where parents are too antagonistic to make things work. But I guess my thought is that that's going to be the minority of cases. And I guess I kind of think about this is that, well, you know, what if we took a more defensive approach with other issues that are important, like drunk driving? You know, what if we had, I think most of us know that this is a public safety issue. And on the other hand, we think that most people are responsible with their alcohol use and driving. But if we were going to kind of take that kind of approach of, well, we gotta set our laws for those few bad apples, then wouldn't we have laws that, you know, the staff in bars and restaurants would breathalyze everybody before they go out the door to get in their car? And I think most of us would probably find that kind of approach offensive because we feel that we can kind of use our better judgment. And I guess, likewise, I feel that the majority of divorced parents are able to work out in a responsible manner what's going to be best for their children. And, you know, I guess through my years of practice, my personal feeling is that, you know, the human condition is such that we have an amazing capacity to rise to the occasion. And that, you know, we may get knocked down, we may need help from others, but that most people keep trying. And I guess I believe that if couples have the understanding from the get-go that things are going to be equal in this respect in terms of their parenting time, that most parents are going to have the ability then to work out what's best for the children. But I really think that that process is going to be easier if the starting point is that they're on equal footing. I guess another thought I have on this is that, yes, a lot of these issues start out with a lot of anger and contentiousness, but what I've observed over time is that that anger in the majority of individuals dissipates. Time heals all wounds. My two cents of advice for you, if you're going to get divorced, and what I tell my patients is don't get in a hurry. Be as polite as you can. If you can't talk nice on the phone, use the internet and email. And wait, because generally what I see with couples is that over time, you know, the tempers do cool down. Any questions?
Any brief questions, members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just ask, if we could just get copies of any of the studies that you're citing, because it would be helpful for us to be able to look at them, and then I won't ask the question again.
Mr. Uecker, Peggy, Representative Scott, can you get that information to us?
He'll forward that to me, and I'll get it to everybody.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Uecker.
Mr. Chair, next on the docket here is Mr. Jerome Schoenecker.
Representative Scott, we're at about 50 minutes left, just for your own calculations. And for the people, members in the audience. Welcome to our committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jerome Schoenecker. and I'm a social worker with a master's degree from Boston University. I am the co-founder of the Resource Center for Fathers and Families and the current director. I run a support group for fathers, teach parenting and step-parenting and relationship classes and workshops, and do some private counseling with individuals and couples. In the past, I've administered a 100-bed psychiatric residential treatment center for children and ran an adoption foster care program, both domestic and international, and had a private practice as a psychotherapist. Because of the unequal status currently experienced...
Sir, could I just have you get a little closer to the microphone?
Sure. Because of the unequal status currently experienced in the family court system, some probably unintended results occur which are very harmful to the children and ultimately to the entire family. The unity of the family must, as nearly as possible, be maintained. When there is open conflict between the parents, the children think they have to choose. Because the permanency barrier has been broken, relationships are now tenuous, so that the children, to survive, will choose the winner. They will choose the one that they spend disciplinary time with, the one who most affects their life. They learn to tell each parent what the parent wants to hear rather than the truth. People don't confront people they're likely to lose. This means that the children have no parents and that they have to protect the parents' feelings rather than having the parents tending to theirs. The RCFF, my agency, makes the following statement to parents that we serve. Your child needs your psychological permission to love the other parent. If you're not able to give this to them, you're telling them that there's a part of them you don't want to know, the part that relates to the other parent. If they cannot talk to that parent about a problem or situation, and they cannot talk to you about it without your feelings getting in the way, they have no parents. To grow up relationally healthy, each child needs two parents who can see their own behavior and take responsibility when they're wrong and hear the problems about the other parent without judging. Two parents who can resolve conflict and regain intimacy and affection for each other. In the absence of that, two separated parents who can at least help them reconcile two differing parenting styles and teach them to judge for themselves what's true and valuable. The adversary nature of the court exacerbates the problem. It invokes the win-lose paradigm. In this paradigm, one is the winner and one is the loser. It presumes a good guy and a villain, one up and one down. The problem is that if the villain starts moving up, the paradigm has it that the good guy is moving down, forcing the adversarial response. They can't both be up. The paradigm requires that both parties believe it in it to make it happen. We try to help parents disbelieve it and to demonstrate the disbelief by supporting the other parent's relationship with the children. In the win-lose paradigm, everybody loses. To disbelieve it requires forgiving the other parent from the heart and taking responsibility for their own actions in a situation, and that's a very difficult thing to do but vitally necessary. When the parents are out of the court system, which enhances the adversarial nature of the relationship, the need to win is minimized because 24/7 is a lot of time, and it becomes obvious that two parents work better than one when they can work together. The court system has a very large support system. Guardians ad litem, custody evaluators, early neutral evaluators, caseworkers, advocates, and attorneys, which largely support the quote winner in the win-lose paradigm. So while in the court system, great damage is done in the name of winning, damage that is emotionally very hard to reverse, especially in a long, drawn-out, or very intensely adversarial process. The joint custody presumption levels the playing field, which makes negotiation possible. When one parent has veto power with no apparent loss to their position, it is destructive to both sides. The loser has lost respect in the eyes of the children, and the, quote, winner has to be fearful of losing their respect, too. The winner knows that in some way that the victory is a hollow one, and they become fearful of losing the children's love and so become their friend, thus abdicating the parental role and becoming a friend to the children. The loser becomes Disney dad or mom with no real time to parent. Both the parents and the children become hostages to the situation and all lose because the parents cease to be the parents and the children don't get to be children protected and managed by two competent parents who both love them and work together to show it. This is not a stance taken for men. 25% of our clients are women. They see the damage done serving none of the parties. When the father is the loser, his mother and sisters and the children's paternal grandparents experience the loser's trauma in trying to be a father to his children and the helplessness he experiences. Mothers themselves, when, quote, winners, see later the devastation done. Our culture is experiencing the results of children growing up with parents too afraid to discipline them, too fearful of losing them. Let's hope it's not too late to do something different. No caring parent would knowingly put their children in this destructive situation if they could see its pending effect on their lives. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Appreciate your testimony. Representative Scott, next.
Joseph Fields.
Welcome to our committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman Westrom and committee members. My name is Joe Field, and I'm an attorney in Anoka. I've been in practice in family law for about 17 years now in Minnesota, and I'm speaking in favor of the proposed bill. I'm going to share with you what I've seen and heard being in the trenches of these custody battles and parenting time fights. And I'll be brief, but hopefully to the point. And what I have to say would be illuminating to the members here. I have seen parents bringing spurious restraining order actions in an attempt to gain a quick strike upper hand in an upcoming custody fight. It's a tactical maneuver used commonly in court proceedings. This is a waste of judicial resources. I have seen parents actively interrogating their kids to gain knowledge of the living conditions of the other parent for purposes of getting the ultimate nod on sole physical custody. I have seen awards of sole physical custody in a number of cases actually enabling custodial parents to become abusive towards their ex. Feeling the power of having sole physical custody, they lord it over the presumed lesser parent, telling them it's my way or the highway, or when I say jump, you respond how high. Got that? And then I've seen the flip side. I have seen both parents trying to amicably come to terms early on in a divorce proceeding. They suggest an agreement that would entail joint physical custody. And then I explain to them the present status of the law, that there's a presumption against joint physical custody. Their response is now predictable. You're kidding me. Why? Well, I go on to explain just how it works, and I inform them that they must get special court approval for joint physical custody, which is not always a guarantee, and that it will involve a court hearing on most cases. They leave dismayed. They want to work it out. They want to get along, and they want to keep their legal costs down. But some realize as they leave that they will be soon forced to draw swords in a winner-take-all custody fight. And the bitter aftermath of that battle will linger on for years, oftentimes until the children become adults and beyond. This is all unnecessary. With the exception of abuse cases, which in my opinion is more the exception of the rule, a presumption in favor of joint physical custody should be the standard. It's better for the kids, and it will greatly diminish the workload of the judiciary, who I've been hearing complaining a lot about their lack of resources. Most family court judges will tell you that the lengthiest trials are the custody trials. They are also the most acrimonious. No one likes cantankerous custody trials. Not the judges, not the lawyers, not the parties, and especially not the kids. We have heard that what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Well, when it comes to custody trials, what happens in the court custody trials unfortunately doesn't stay in the courtroom. It is brought home, and the kids pay the price. Custody trials should be the card played played as a last resort, not the first card laid down. It is time for the archaic presumption against joint physical custody to end. For the sake of the judiciary, for the sake of the parents, and more importantly, for the sake of our children, change the statutory presumption to favor joint physical custody.
Mr. Chair, next we have Stephen Erickson.
Mr. Erickson, welcome to the committee. You may proceed. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Steve Erickson. I'm a mediator. I'm person who conducted his first divorce as a young law student in 1973, and I have an opportunity to have been in this field long enough to have seen tremendous change. And I think this bill, the reason I'm here in support of this, is because this bill is a logical progression from where we've been to where we need to be. When I first started practicing law in 1974, we had a fault system. The legislature wisely changed that in 1974. Up until 1978, there was a presumption that the non-custodial visiting parent could not sign for medical emergencies, could not visit the teacher. We had almost a presumption of termination of parental rights of the non-custodial visiting parent. We wisely got rid of that in 1978. In the early 80s, when I working as a mediator, we early mediators realized that it was easier to solve this custody battle if we started talking about parenting plans. And the mediators in this country take credit for changing that shift into thinking about parenting plans. And in 1998, I was part of a group of eight or nine of us with Representative Dawkins. We came to the legislature and said, we need to have a parenting plan legislation that throws out these labels. And if you think about it, the only other place we use the word custody is with prisoners. The only other place we use the word visitation is at the funeral parlors. I think our children deserve better treatment. And yet we label it that way. We mediators know that we have a saying that the person who defines the problem has a great deal of power over the outcome. So when people come into my room and I'm working with them in mediation, and I say, well, what's the single biggest problem you're have conflict over? They say custody. I say, well, I'm not going to have the definition be that. If you think about it, it's the court system saying to you, the problem you have is you have to figure out which one of you is a better or worse parent based upon the application of the 14 best interest test. In my mediation room, I'm going to say to them, I think the real problem is rather what are the future parenting arrangements the two of you can agree on so you can be the types of parents you need to be, whether that's equal or unequal time sharing. And we've had great success in that. And in 2002, the legislature wisely adopted parenting plan legislation. We had hoped it would be mandatory, but it wasn't. But it's still changed. It's changed things. I have attorneys in my office now when I'm doing a mediation where a client says, well, what about custody? And the attorney turns to the client and says, well, we don't do that anymore. We just build parenting plans. It's easier to build parenting plans. So there's really a progression of moving away from the battle. And so this bill does several things well. It throws out the labels. When I teach these divorce education classes, I ask the people in the room, these are mostly parents going through divorce, I say, how many of you are going to face a custody battle or are fearing that? Maybe half the room. And I ask them, how many of you have eight-year-olds? A few of them raise their hands, and I'll say, I guarantee you, what's tonight, Thursday night? Tomorrow, Friday. I guarantee you when your eight-year-old leaves the leaves the schoolroom and goes out to the bus, your eight-year-old does not turn to his best friend and say, oh, this weekend, if you want to get a hold of me, call me up over at my non-custodial, non-residential, non-primary, non-psychological, secondary visitation, Disneyland in Texas, my non-managing conservator's home. It's only us adults that use those gradations and labels. And we like to do that because we are sitting in an adversarial system that's really designed to do one thing well. It determines guilt and innocence. It determines right-wrong. It determines good parent, bad parent. And it's time to move away from that. We don't need to spend our time determining good parent, bad parent anymore. So I had to think long and hard about coming down here because I'm a mediator, and suddenly there's a bill that says, oh, we should do 50-50 time sharing. Maybe the majority of my couples do 50-50 time sharing. There are still a lot of couples that will not. There are a lot of couples that it's not appropriate for. But that can be shaken out in the discussions, the mediations, the negotiations, the litigation. It seems to me it would be easier to have that played out if the starting point was, we think both of you are good parents, and we expect you to be good parents, and we expect you to be responsible parents. That probably means equivalent parents. But now it's up to you to say why it shouldn't be equivalent, rather than for one of you to say, I want more time and have to fight for that forever. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Mr. Harris, I think?
Yep, Todd Harris.
Todd Harris. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Harris. If you can identify yourself for the record, you may proceed.
My name is Todd Harris. I live in Maple Grove, Minnesota. And I support the House Bill 322, a presumption for joint physical custody and equal sharing, shared parenting. And this is my two-minute story. Okay. Guilty, having committed an offense, crime, violation, or wrong, especially against moral or penal law. Justly subject to certain accusation or penalty. Second definition, having a showing of sense of guilt, whether real or imagined. This is how I feel after 18 years of strong and demanding effort. Next definition, criminal, senseless, foolish, or pertaining to crime or its punishment. This is how I feel because I've been kept away from someone that is part of me. These are a couple of words that describe how I felt as a willing and able parent of a now 18-year-old young man. At this point in time in our relationship, I just don't have the tight bond that a dad should have, that a dad should feel towards their son. He has now graduated from high school and is currently trying to find himself as a young man to becoming a man. His road is a little more difficult now because I was not allowed to be that consistent, empowering, loving parent that I wanted to be. I really should feel more of a bond with him, but it is really hard to have that bond when every time I see him, it's like starting all over again. I could not tell you how hard it is to keep meeting your son for the first time every other week. By the time you catch up with him on how he's been doing, your 2 days are already over. Instead of most dads in my position are forced to force all their knowledge and attention to their child's future well-being in approximately 48 hours every other week or 4 days a month. My question to you is, how much influence as a parent could you actually be to a child 48 days a year, which is only 1,152 hours, when there is approximately 8,760 hours in a year, which calculates your time with your child to be approximately 13% of the time? Well, let me tell you, it's not much at all. I am angry, disgusted, embarrassed, humiliated, and bitter at how our court system is run. The word system in my last sentence means an ordered and comprehensive assemblage of facts, principles, doctrines, or the like in a particular field of knowledge or thought. There is no way that this system should be called a system when principles are being thrown away as if a father doesn't matter, when facts are total disregard to whether or not father is willing and wanting to be a valuable part of the child's life, or when knowledge and thought is not given when decisions are made by courts to rip the child away from the child or children away from their father without knowing wanting to know or understand the father's values of love of their child. In these courts, fathers are guilty until proven innocent, and even then, that is still not enough. We're just guilty. Even criminals such as robbers or murderers serve a lighter sentence than a sentence we have given away from our children. The definition, parent, a father or mother, a protector or guardian. This is what I should be without outside interference of someone or something that doesn't know me or what I stand for. Definition of father, a man who exercises paternal care over other persons, paternal protector or provider. This is what I should fully feel like after seeing my son cross the stage at his graduation, instead of wondering why I need to be in meetings like this, fighting to help others with their 18 years of confinement. And lastly, the only problem that I have with the definition of father is that our courts only want us to be providers who cannot exercise paternal care or protection. This seems to be a business in which fathers are taxed and not given any credit. Fathers are given no rights in personal or financial care. The more you take from us, the less we can be. Fathers are being used as another source of income. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Representative Scott, we're at a half hour left, just for your information. Whoever's next, you can have them come up.
Next is, that was Mr. Harris, right?
Yes.
Greg McGillis.
Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the record. You may proceed.
My name is Greg McGillis. I was divorced back in 1981 in Morrison County. They only had sole physical custody. My wife was awarded sole physical custody. In my divorce decree, my visitation was 24-hour reasonable visitation with half holidays. I was denied every other weekend and 2 weeks during the summer, which I never was able to share with my children. In regards to the 24-hour reasonable visitation, I would ask my wife, ex-wife, 24 hours, 48 hours a week, 2 weeks to a month, and I was denied 90% of the time. You know, how this affected my children was, as my son started to have behavior problems at the age of 3. He was basically, the school was concerned about suicide at age of 6. Eighth grade, he started to drink. And then when he was a sophomore, he was arrested. At that time, even though my ex-wife had sole physical custody, the court awarded temporary custody to me. I had my son approximately for a year, which would be temporary custody. He was then turned back over to my ex-wife, which took him down to the Twin Cities. He was arrested there. The judge then reversed her decision, which is unheard of, and gave me full physical custody. At that time, my wife and my ex-wife and my son were allowed to see each other anytime they wanted. That was worked out between the two. But what it did to my son, it absolutely destroyed him. I almost lost him to suicide. I almost lost him to alcoholism. He had to go in and get treatment. And I think it's really an injustice to where a child is denied the right to see the non-custodial parent, whether it be the mother or whether it be the father. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next is Kathy Cleavy.
Welcome to the committee. You may proceed. Identify yourself for the record.
Okay, thank you. My name is Kathy Cleavy, and I live in Maplewood, Minnesota. I'm here to testify in favor of HF 322 for presumption of joint physical custody and equal shared parenting. As a concerned citizen, stepmother, and wife, I feel the negative effect of the current system must change. My husband and his ex-wife separated in December of 1998 when his twin boys were 2.5 years old. She refused his request to co-parent their boys, so they worked with an agreed-upon mediator for parenting time and divorce issues. He was granted parenting time of one night a week for 3 hours and every other weekend and some shared holidays, beginning in January of 1999. Basically, he was allowed to be a dad to his boys and a part of their life for 15% of the time. Since that day, those kids have been her kids, not their kids, and she has refused to follow the court order for parenting time. In the first 3 months of their separation, he saw his boys a total of 30 hours. That was when he made his first trip back to court. Since then, there have been 4 more trips to court, all with the same judge in Ramsey County, and all because of her refusal to follow the court order. Each time, the judge has assigned someone new to evaluate the case. Over the years, there have been 4 different evaluators and 2 guardian ad litems assigned to review the case. In addition, my husband and his ex engaged a parenting consultant a few years ago who had authority, backed by the court and their agreement, to oversee the entire parenting time process. Each time, my husband has been the one who has had to prove himself worthy of having visitation with his kids, yet she was the one refusing to follow the court order. The number of people who get involved in these cases is ridiculous and intrusive. But even so, every person the court has appointed and the parenting consultant have said the same thing. There is absolutely no reason that he shouldn't see his kids and have regular parenting time scheduled. As such, the courts have always sided with him and ordered her to follow the scheduled parenting time. The only time she has ever followed the court order is during the 2-year period when the parenting consultant was engaged, and that was because of the authority the parenting consultant was given in their agreement. Unfortunately, they had only a 2-year agreement. When that expired, she refused to engage the parenting consultant because she didn't like their findings, and my husband's attempt to get the court to order it for the sake of the kids fell on deaf ears. I support this bill, HF 322, for presumption of joint physical custody and equal shared parenting. I believe it is the only way my husband's high conflict and defiant ex-wife would ever begin to comply. The current law giving this woman sole custody and the majority of time has exasperated her resistance to the father's involvement and been extremely detrimental to these kids. This bill would establish upfront that both parents are equally responsible and equally necessary. And with this law, when the mother refuses to get along, it will no longer be easier for her to shut dad out. We all have 2 parents. We all identify with both parents, and they are who we are. Why both parents should not share equally in the raising of kids in a divorce is beyond comprehension. Why do we insist on punishing innocent kids by putting more value on their time with one parent over the other? Just because the parents can't get along doesn't mean the kids should be deprived of time with either parent. With that, there has to be accountability to the courts for ensuring enforcement of these agreements. If my husband missed paying his child support, the laws in the system are set up that he would lose his driver's license and go to jail. There should be equal punishment for women who don't allow their children to see their father when the schedule has been laid out in a court order. I know this case is not isolated. Please consider adding this penalty in this law to give it even more teeth and require the judges to do something. In my husband's case, his ex-wife has made a mockery of the family court system in Ramsey County. She knows there are no ramifications for not following the court order. She has never been held accountable for not following it. She is no different than a 5-year-old that is told they can't do something. If they go ahead and do it anyway and there are no consequences, they will continue to do it over and over again and get more and more bold in their defiance. How does this impact the kids? Terribly. We are going on month 16 now of not having seen or heard from his kids. Think about it. These kids have had no contact with their father for 16 months. He can't even call them to talk to them. In the 12 years since they separated and then divorced, the kids have never been allowed to answer the phone when he calls, nor will she. These kids grew up in an environment where when the phone rang, they always had to find out who was calling, and if it was their dad, they were not allowed to answer the phone. In fact, in February of 2001, when they were back in court again over her refusal to follow the visitation, she was ordered to allow him phone access to the kids, which she never did, and again with no ramifications. These are kids that I have been around over the last 7 years. I've known them. I've seen them with their dad. I know how much they love him and love being with him. I also have seen how absolutely paralyzed with fear they are of even looking at their dad, let alone talking to him when their mother is present. What the mother has done to these kids over the years in her attempt to alienate them and keep them from their dad is criminal. However, the fact that the court system has allowed and enabled her behavior all this time is incomprehensible. The court has failed in its duty to protect these children. The court has failed in their discretion. Since the courts have failed in their discretion, the legislature needs to direct them more, not less. The court has assisted in destroying a family. There are two 14-and-a-half-year-old twin boys who no longer have a father in their life, a father that loves them more than anything in the world. The family court system is supposed to protect the kids. That is their job. In my husband's case, they failed miserably. Sure, he can take her back to court again for not following the court order, but how many times does he have to get beat up over this? The judge has proven he has no desire to protect the kids and will not do anything to punish her for her actions. I know that if I repeatedly didn't do my job, I wouldn't have it anymore. The court has got to follow the laws that are written to protect the kids in these situations. If there are judges that for whatever reason can't do it, then they shouldn't have a job. For any of you that have children, I want you to stop and think about how devastating it would be to you and your kids if they were kept from you for 16 months. And I'm not even talking about the 10.5 years prior to that where he saw them at her discretion only. And while in our case we are going on month 16 of absolutely no contact, keep in mind that there is no end in sight for this. My husband has run out of options. If the courts won't do their job, who will? He lives with the fear every day that he may never see his boys again. And for that, the court needs to be held accountable. This bill is a step in the right direction. Without this bill, the courts will refuse to change. And without this bill, judges will continue to destroy families. With this bill, there is hope for the children. Please just add an amendment somewhere along the way that will require judges to make mothers experience consequences when they don't comply with the court order. We need this bill not just for my husband's two sons, but for all the children of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's keep the clapping and comments absent from the hearing on both sides. Mr. Tim Kinley, welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name is Tim Kinley. Been involved in a number of parental rights groups and judicial reform groups. The groups I've been with have changed their focus on presumption of joint physical custody because we saw something happening in the courts where judges don't have to follow the law. And they say that, appellate courts upheld that. They can do whatever they want. And I knew with Molly's group, CPR, that they were doing a great job, so the groups I've been involved with have changed their focus. Just a couple things on the bill that's before you. I'm concerned about the, I think it should, if this is enacted, it should be when the governor signs it, or July 1st of 2011. The judges know what a presumption means. This is not something they have to go out and figure out and how do I work this out. They know what's going on. This is something I think they can do very easily. Plus, it would give also 6 months of, at least 6 months of practice before the next legislative season in case there needs to be some change. And I also have concerns about this bill not being retroactive for the very fact that if a parental right is a fundamental foundational right, then it should apply to all. Why should some be slaves and others free? It's that kind of concept there. But this is a simple concept here. It's a concept that was considered an unalienable right by our founding fathers, so unalienable that not only did they mention it in the Declaration of Independence, they also enshrined it in the Constitution of the United States. They also died for it. What is this right? It's the creator-given, unalienable right, a presumption of innocence until proven guilty. What a novel concept. But that's not what happens in our courts today. You don't have this presumption of innocence. There is this best interest of the child standard, but I just have to read this court order from a judge, and this is typical of what judges think of the best interest of the child standard. And it just goes to the point that parents don't have any fundamental rights with their children. James T. Swenson of Hennepin County District Court said this, and I quote, "The court is troubled," which it wasn't, "with the prospect of permanently depriving a biological parent of the custody of his child when he is neither unfit nor has a history of abandoning that child now that the biological custodial mother has passed on. However, the legislature and higher courts have spoken, and they have crafted the best interest test. When that test is applied to the particular facts herein, the result is clear. So many of the best interest factors favor the petitioner, some convincingly, that this court could not award custody to the respondent without abusing its discretion." Not unfit, no history of abandoning the child, fully engaged in this child's life. The mother even put it in her will. She was having heart surgery. She knew it was about a 5% chance of survival. Put it in the will that the father get the child. And the appellate courts ruled in favor of the couple that were trying to get the child. The father was out. The father, again, was denied his rights. Then the Supreme Court heard it. Two of the Supreme Court justices here in Minnesota said, give the child to the father right now. The rest said, send it back to district court before the same judge and let him put a little bit more weighting that this is the biological parent. You got to understand something. This is not abnormal. This judge was just bold enough to say it. Okay, but that is the kind of the philosophy behind here. How can we remove a parent? Now, not all judges are bad. You know, majority of them are good. But there's a significant, I know we've probably got a lot of disagreement here in the audience with that. But there are 20, in my opinion, 20 to 40% that have no interest in following the law. They're the judge. They can do what they want. They say that. And it's a tragedy going on in the courtroom. This person had to spend $100,000 to get his child back, and fortunately, that individual saw 3 years with their child before they died of a heart attack. And I knew that man, and I knew his daughter, and that daughter loved her dad. And many people in here, and Bob Creel and Attorney Mark Olson fought hard for those 3 years for that daughter, and that daughter never regretted that. But this happens on a daily basis. Judges say, oh, you can't teach your children any inappropriate religious ideas or force them into Bible lessons. No evidentiary hearing. Okay, denied. No findings of fact. No conclusions of law. Just thrown into court order. 5 years down the road, it takes to get that overturned, but you then have to go back before that court. It's a financial devastation. This bill is a good bill. It's a good start. We still, as a state, need to strengthen our fundamental parental rights here and try not to have the philosophy of removing a parent. These judges know this is about money. And they design their court orders around that money because they know their income is derived by getting child support. $200 million coming from the federal government every year for the collection of child support money that comes into the system. They know that, okay? And they have a conflict of interest when they make these decisions. This presumption will be good for the state, good for the families, and good for the children of Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Kinley. Representative Scott, we have about 12 minutes left on your side. Next one.
Hardy and Daniel Probst.
Marty and Daniel, thank you for coming. Please introduce yourself and for the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Daniel Probst.
My name is Marty Probst. I'll let Danny go first.
Go ahead, Daniel.
Hi, I'm 17 years old. I'm currently a senior down at high school. And when my parents started the divorce, I was 11 years old. Since then, my sisters and I have gone through turmoil that has been caused by this divorce. I have two younger sisters, both age 14. Since the beginning, my sisters and I have asked for week-on, week-off arrangement. We have communicated that to our parents without any regard. Later, we told the judge that this was our request, but he refused. My mother had gone for full physical custody and was granted that initially, with only visiting time for my father. Later, after more court battles, my dad was given every other weekend. In my case, I am now in a 5-2-2-5 schedule. I spend Monday and Tuesday with my mother, Wednesday and Thursday with my father, and Friday, Saturday, Sunday every other. I'm currently packing up 2-3 times a week to change houses, and my sisters are on the same schedule except for they only have Monday with, or they only have Thursday with my father and every other weekend. My parents have spent numerous amounts of money on lawyer fees to oppose the schedule between both of them taking each other back to court multiple times. Currently, there is no money left for our family. We can see the stress on our parents at all times. Financially, it's been unbearable for all of us between basic financial responsibilities of each parent. We've had to move out of our primary home and move into smaller homes because of the court battles. Since then, my sister, in one particular, has gone ill many times due to this, due to stress. The other one has been socially retracted from everything around her. This fall, I plan to go to college, and unfortunately, my parents are no longer in a position to help me pay for that. I'm forced to choose a college based on what I may be able to afford from what I make from working. If we had a week-on, week-off schedule from the beginning as requested, not only time, but numerous amounts of money and stress would have been saved, and there's no question that we'd all be in a better position for it. Thank you.
Thank you, Marty. Or Daniel, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, just to reiterate real quick from my perspective, I thank my son for coming up, and it was not easy to get him to come and talk. As you said, our divorce started 6 years ago simply because my wife and I, she didn't want to be married anymore. And when the kids from the beginning asked for week on, week off, she said, no, that's not going to happen. You're going to live with me, and Dad's going to come by for a ball game every once in a while. There was no alcohol. There's no gambling. There's no drugs. There's no abuse in this in any way, shape, or form. These are two fit parents. Both love their children. The battle went on. We're still battling. We were in court on Monday. We'll be in court again on the 25th of this month, again, to try and get that time back. We have spent over $300,000 on legal fees for this. The stress or the toll it's taken on my business and the kids, the grades of the kids, and so forth is hard to calculate. All that we've been through four judges, multiple custody evaluators, because all of a sudden we're going through a divorce, and my parenting is now under scrutiny. I have to go through and be evaluated. I have a coach of all three of my kids, two of my the girls, and so forth. We've gone through multiple parenting consultants, guardian ad litem, multiple therapists, mediators, all of that. They keep getting run through, all because we're supposedly have to be evaluated on whether or not we can parent our two children, our three children. My wife, my ex, even used the false order for protection to get me removed from my house. Three times she called the police, and each time the police listed me as the victim. She had to keep calling. Finally, she gave up and just filed for false order of protection. She got it. Same month that David Letterman got a false order of protection against him by a woman in Phoenix he had never met. She saw him on TV. I had that case heard. It was dismissed. I was given the children, but I was not allowed to go back into my house. I had 48 hours to find a house, even though it was proven false. There's a false order for protection in Minnesota. It's a criminal and civil penalties for that. No one has ever been prosecuted for it. When I called Hennepin County Sheriff after giving up with my local police station, the sheriff said, oh, that's family court. People do that all the time, falsely accuse people of everything. I said, is that okay? He said, we're not going to do anything about it. It's just leave it. Go do something else with your time, is what he said. I know multiple people that have been through the false order for protection. I never, ever touched my wife other than to guide her out of a room that she came through a locked door multiple times. And that's why it was dismissed. It was made up to get me removed from my house, and it worked. I have never been able to go back into my house unless I had a police escort in front of my children for no more than 15 minutes at a time. And I've never done anything physically to her. I've never been arrested for anything. I don't have a record any other way other than that. I say that the JPC, this bill is a good start. You've heard a lot of other great testimony. I wish you would consider what it's doing to the families in Minnesota, because my story pales in comparison to things that I've heard from multiple other people and families. I mean, the kids are losing by this. It's one thing for the parents to have to deal with this, but the kids have the effect of it, and we got to stop this. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming in and spending your evening here at the Capitol. Representative Scott, we're down to about 4 minutes left. Can we have both your next two testifiers come and each split
sure.
the time?
Jack Elrich.
I want to first of all thank everybody for taking the time out of your evening to hold this hearing. I think this bill is very important. My name is Jack Ehrlich, and I live in Rockford, Minnesota, and I'm a single dad. My children and I are lucky because after many court battles, we actually have exactly 50-50 parenting time between the children's mom and myself. But in order to get it, I had to spend $150,000 in legal fees, and it was very hard on the children. I've also volunteered support and advice to many parents going through divorce. What I see over and over again is that the current custody process yields the wrong information, and courts consistently and repeatedly make the wrong decisions, really bad decisions. When I started the proceedings personally, I was pretty naive. I didn't think I'd have any trouble getting joint physical custody. I'd been through my business law classes and heard about joint property and, you know, had no clue what I was about to head into. I had no history of abuse. I had no chemical dependency issues. I had no criminal background other than a speeding ticket in 1986, and I had no record of any mental health issues. I was financially stable. I was running a company with 90 people reporting to me. I'd been faithful to my wife. I was a dedicated father. I was an involved dad who coached my kids' teams. I wrote them songs, and I sang them to them every night before they would go to bed. And most important, I love those kids with all my heart. The children's mom and I agreed we didn't want a custody battle, and we would share custody. There were no issues. But then she attended a divorce seminar at a local women's center in Minneapolis, where she learned about the divorce process, and she was referred to an attorney who encouraged her to go for sole physical custody. The tension in the divorce didn't just escalate, it exploded. The process was damaging for the children, and it was totally unnecessary. It was driven only by the fact that one parent did not want to share control. During our first hearing, the Hennepin County judge made us go to what they called an early neutral evaluation. This was a complete waste of time and only made things worse and ran up more attorney's fees. That was followed by a six-week evaluation. The Hennepin County evaluator recommended sole physical custody to the mother and that I should see my children only one night every 2 weeks.
Just 1 minute left.
So okay.
If you can.
The evaluator, I just want to say, she said that what was important to her was that I got a cat and that I must have gotten the cat to manipulate the children's emotions. That was the deciding reason. The only reason I got the cat was because I, you know, had lost my entire family and I wanted a pet to come home to. Event, you know, I've got 1 minute, so I'm going to cut this short, but the experts weren't able to draw the right conclusions. What this bill will help eliminate that. My daughter is now choosing between Northwestern and Harvard. Since she came to live with me, her grades shot up. She's one of the top students at Wayzata. That $150,000 we spent on attorney's fees could be used to send her to Harvard right now, and she could graduate debt-free. The current process is very harmful to families and children. I think this bill is a godsend, and I ask that you vote for this and that you pass it. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Scott, we're at the 90 minutes, and so I understand there's one more testifier, but we're going to have to move to the opponents at this point in time. If there's time left after that, we will open it up to the audience if there's people that want to testify, and we've gotten word that there are a few that would like to. So,
all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scott. And we'll now move to the opponents of this bill, and the first witness, Mr. John Kosiliskin. If you want to come forward, and we will start 90 minutes. Welcome to the committee. If you can identify yourself for our record, you may proceed. And right now we have two yourself and one other person that have asked to testify opposed to this bill. And so we'll open it up to others that have interest if you don't use the 90 minutes.
I will try not to use the 90 minutes, Mr. Chairman, myself.
Well, just you can allocate accordingly, but I think the committee and those in the audience would appreciate it if you don't have 90 minutes prepared. So
thank you.
Please proceed. Identify yourself for the record. Thank you for coming.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Kosiliskin. I have a handout that I prepared for members, which will cover most of the comments that I have to make here this evening. And I provided 50 copies, so I hope there's enough to go around. If there isn't any, I actually will be taking this packet and publishing it on my website. I actually have my divorce case is so large that I actually have a website set up for it. And if you go to divorce.kysylyshin, it's K-Y-S-Y. lyczyn.com. That's where I'm in the process of posting all 5,000 pages worth of court documents in my case, and I'll make sure I put that packet that I handed out here up there tonight. On the first page, I have some biographical information, and then on the next pages, unfortunately, I come into the position here of where I have some positive comments to make about the bill, and I also have some concerns that I want to make about the bill. So I fall 50-50, half and half. As I read through the bill, I saw two different distinct parts to this bill. The first part I saw was there's a part of this bill that I believe raises the standards and increases the professionalism and also lowers costs in the system. I'm happy to see that there's the word conviction is used on line 424, page 4, line 24. I'm also happy to see the statement about protective orders under page 8, line 19. I think I raised the question of whether some of these orders here have credibility in this process. One person mentioned about the David Letterman incident. Another incident was a person in Chicago received a signed protective order against themselves. The judiciary just simply signed off on it, apparently without looking at it, noticing that the complainant was also the victim. Now, in my opinion, these protection orders, and I've experienced this firsthand because I've been in the court system for... Let's see here, from the date I was served to the date I received the judgment, it was 850 days in the system. And I went through the protection order process myself. We had a situation where a judge signed a protective order against me without even consulting the police department. did not hear any evidence or conducted an investigation, yet the judge signed off on the protective order. The next day, the police department issued a report that was actually based on an investigation, and they came to the opposite conclusion of the judge. In the opinion of three police officers and one domestic violence investigator, they all conflicted with the court's findings. So in the end, the judge ended up, after hearing, issuing orders for protection against both myself and my wife, two orders, then ordered us to share the home and have personal contact with each other multiple times every weekday. Then several months later, the city attorney issued a letter saying that the order was so poorly written that it was unenforceable. Also, in talking with officers in Roseville, I found out that the stack of orders, protection orders, he said was this high, and that they come in on a fax machine, and they just keep getting stacked up and stacked up in the pile, and they get higher and higher. Another officer told me that the only time that some of them give great concern to protection orders is when somebody in the community actually has two of them against them from two different people. So that's kind of the level you have to rise to before there's a certain level of seriousness put into them. The only thing I found that the protection orders did in my case was cause me to be detained by the Border Patrol for 30 minutes every single time I attempted to enter the country. So from three different Border Patrol stations, I was held for 30 minutes while the Border Patrol agents scratched their head trying to figure out what these orders meant. And then after about 30 minutes, they kind of put their hands up and said, well, we don't know what's going on here. Go. So that's the level of seriousness and credibility that some of these protection orders have. So I'm glad to see that that's going to be addressed in this bill. As far as costs are concerned, I spent $5,000 at least defending against that frivolous protection order. Also, later on in my case, I had about 750 pages worth of motion papers filed against me that were chock full of allegations. That took a half a day's worth of the court's time and probably about $5,000 of my own money to defend against that. And keep in mind the fees that the court collects every time these hearings are filed. In many of the hearings, there's no fees that are collected. In some of the hearings, maybe the fee is $100 or $200. In most of these hearings, we probably burned up thousands of dollars worth of court time on these crazy hearings that were mainly designed about positioning oneself, getting a score up on the other side. And I think that the recommended changes here are going to help in that issue. I'm also happy to see that this is not retroactive. I know there's a lot of people that here that probably believe it should be, and I respect their opinion on that. I guess, though, we burned through $100,000 in 3 years in court, and if this was made retroactive, I know I'm going to be right back in court and probably have to go through another $50,000 to relitigate this case, and I don't want to go there. The only beneficiary is going to be the divorce attorneys, in my opinion. Or at least they're going to be the primary financial beneficiaries. Now, I also think this bill works great for parents who both work outside of the home full-time, but this gets to the point of where I want to raise the concerns I have about the bill. Now, I've provided my my six bullet points in my document here, but what I'd like to do is just, for time purposes here, focus on my examples, and I'll look at my case first here. I am a state-licensed family daycare provider in Ramsey County, and I, of course, I've cared for other people's kids, and I care for my own kids in my home. The ex-wife is a CPA who works outside of the home 45 to 65 hours a week. Now, under the current law we have, the judge awarded me 58% of the parenting time. But because the calculation did not include her time at lunch, overtime, travel time to work, the reality has been it's been more around 70%. I have 70% of the kids' time. She has 30% of the children's time. Now, that works under the current law, but my concern is under the proposed bill that we have here, because as I read it, it seems like it is nearly impossible to overcome the presumption of joint legal, joint physical custody. And it also states that the definition of physical custody means 45 to 55% time for each parent. So when I add all this together, it seems to be, as I read the bill, next to near impossible to get beyond the 45% to 55% number. So how do you do that in my situation? Well, we can do what my ex-wife asked the court to do. She asked the court to have the children placed in daycare 10 days a month in order to equalize the time between the parents, the amount of time that the face time that the parents had with the children. Of course, then she also asked the court to bill me for the cost, for part of the cost of placing the children in outside daycare. So this is the scenario I'm trying to paint here. I'm a state licensed daycare provider, and I believe the way this bill is written, the judge would have to, in order to equalize the parenting time, order that my kids be placed in somebody else's daycare. Then I would probably take in one or two additional children, other people's children, to raise the money to pay for that outside daycare. That's the only way you can meet a 50-50 parenting schedule when one parent is a state-licensed daycare provider and is caring for their own children in the home and the other parent works outside of the home. Example number two is an example of a friend of mine who's a stewardess at Delta Airlines and lives in Roseville. It's a similar type of a scenario. Odd schedules, I believe, may have problems with this proposed law. Example number three also raises a question about the money. I was able to show the judge in my case that it was far more financially beneficial to both parties if I care for the children at home for free, but no cost, than it was to pay for outside daycare in order to equalize the time. Even though that did meant that I got a little bit more child support money, but it still actually was more beneficial financially to both parties to do it that way. And so those are my concerns that I have with House File 322. I think in many of the divorce cases where both parents work outside of the house, they're both working 40 hours a week, I think what's being proposed here is very fair and reasonable. It's those maybe the minority of cases where you have either stay-at-home parents, parents that operate their own daycares, or parents that are self-employed and work out of the home and can care for children for more hours, that I think we run into a problem with this strict 50-50 parenting. I think it could result in some pretty bizarre decisions if that was adhered to and there was no flexibility with it. My solutions to it, and I just bring these up, I just throw these out there as possible solutions, is maybe instead of focusing on percentages, we look at focusing on time spent with our children. I don't know if anybody's done an analysis of this, but maybe a way to approach this issue better is to state that we should have a minimum amount of time that parents should have directly with their children. And I'm not talking about time that people are asleep or time the children are at school, because that's not time that parents interact with their children. I'm talking about time that parents would interact either at home, scouting, sports games, so on and so forth. And maybe that's a different way of looking at this. But what I would ask is, I hope this bill moves forward. There are a lot of good things in it, but this issue just, these situations here need to be addressed, and I hope that they do get addressed in the process here. I'll stand for questions, if there are any.
Thank you. Anybody with questions, members? Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Kiselichin.
Yep.
First person I've ever met that's got four Y's in her last name. So on balance, you think the bill is the right direction to go. I understand you've got some kind of maybe micro concerns that might appear in these different areas. You also understand that the way the bill is written, there is the ability for parents to negotiate outside of the presumption. But on balance, you think we're going in the right direction if we adopt this bill?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I
Mr. Kislichin.
I think, yes, I would agree with that, that we are going in the correct direction. Why I do bring the concern, though, I do understand that if there's agreement between the parties that they can go outside what is being recommended in this bill. But in my particular case, I was in a scenario of where the other party simply did not agree to that. The other party was very firm in their position that they did not want the other parent to get more time than them. And so therefore, that parent, under this new proposal here, could have created some problems with that. You know, if both parties are working together, then that certainly wouldn't be an issue. But we have to figure out what do we do with when one parent decides they are going to take that position. I don't want to cooperate. I want the kids put in daycare rather than spending time with their mom, or I want the kids put in daycare rather than spending time with their dad. We need to figure out a way to get around that because that's like I told the judge in my case, I says my number one goal is that the children spend the maximum amount of time with their parents. That parents come before daycare, parents come before everything else. Parents come before grandparents, in my opinion. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Otherwise, we have one more witness. Thank you, Mr. Kislichin. If I got that close to right, Mr. Ditmerner, Mike Ditmerner. Welcome to our committee. Please identify yourself for the record, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Ditmerner, and I'm the legislative chair of the Minnesota chapter of American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. My organization is an organization of family law attorneys. We're nationwide, and we have this local chapter of approximately 50 attorneys or so. It was my organization's initiative several years ago which led to the successful legislative repeal of the presumption in favor of the primary residential parent's ability to change a child's residence to another state over the objection of the so-called non-physical custodial parent. With this legislative change, now the person who seeks to move to another state has the burden of proving that such a move is in the child's best interests. I've been practicing since 1984. I've testified before House and Senate committees regarding proposed family law legislation and its impact on the family court system on numerous prior occasions over the course of the past 20-plus years, first as a representative of the family law section of the State Bar Association, and then in my current role as representative of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. My personal perspective on joint physical custody is that I don't oppose it at all in concept. I don't think there should be a presumption against it. I don't think that one party's opposition to it should prevent courts from ordering it where appropriate. I don't think that courts should require people that have an agreement to have to go to court to get special judicial permission to have that agreement approved and to have it reviewed if they agree to it. But the problems with House File 322, and as much as it relates to the whole issue of this presumption, are several. First of all, I want to note that it creates a presumption not just in favor of joint physical custody, but also 45.1% parenting time, which gives the impression that the legislation is intended to affect child support, because Section 518 capital A, .36 of our statutes provides for calculation of lower child support awards when the parenting time is between 45.1% and 50% of the time. This goes against one of the purposes of the income shares statute that was adopted by this legislature several years ago, which sets up three different tiers of child support based on three different levels of parenting time, between 0 to 10%, 10 to 45%, and 45 to 50%. When the other legislation was enacted that created a presumption in favor of 25% parenting time, that really didn't have any kind of consequences or risks in terms of litigation over child support, because it's right smack in the middle of this 10 to 45% parenting time. What this legislation will do is provide a huge financial incentive for parties to litigate over parenting time in order to influence what happens with child support. And it's unfortunate because one of the things that we've also tried to do is to get away from, as Mr. Erickson, the mediator, was testifying, labels. More and more family law attorneys and their clients are entering into agreements where we try to do away with a label like physical custody and enter to a parenting plan that just talks about parenting time and access. I'm concerned that this focus on this label of joint physical custody is going to undo a lot of these efforts to get away from the focus of labels. The other problem that I see is that this presumption can only be rebutted by a showing of parental unfitness by clear and convincing evidence, and not just mere unfitness. The unfitness has to be of such a nature that it would cause, quote-unquote, substantial harm to the child. Moreover, before there can be any modification of parenting time, which reduces parenting time, either on a temporary or permanent basis, this legislation provides that the court must find by clear and convincing evidence that the parent's behavior rises to a level of maltreatment or neglect such as would cause a juvenile court judge to find that the child is in need of protective services or to find that the parent is chemically dependent. According to the legislation, mere allegations will not suffice. This must be proved by clear and convincing evidence. And as a result, for the first time, the standard for determining a joint custody award will not be the best interest of the child, but rather the proposal of a parent to have equal parenting time with the child. And I think that that's very problematic. This notion that the presumption can only be rebutted by a showing of parental unfitness will breed a fault-based litigation over whether somebody is a bad parent, especially given the financial incentives offered by the link to its impact on child support awards. I think that it's important to have a little bit of institutional memory here, and so I want to talk about what happened about 25 years ago, when the last time that we had parental unfitness used as a method of rebutting a custody award. 25 years ago, approximately, the Minnesota Supreme Court in the Pakula, P-I-K-U-L-A case, created a primary caretaker presumption, a presumption in favor of awarding sole physical custody of a child to a child's primary caretaker, where the child was too young to express a custodial parent preference. Usually it's a child less than 8 years old. The presumption could only be rebutted by showing that this primary caretaker was unfit to be the physical custodian. Not only was this presumption unfair to fathers, but it also encouraged litigation, very nasty litigation over whether the primary caretaker was unfit to parent. I'm afraid that this legislation, by focusing on fitness or lack thereof, is going to only create a return to those days of fault-based family, fault-based custody litigation. And by the way, I should point out, it was the family law section of the Minnesota State Bar Association that proposed the legislation that did away with the primary caretaker presumption, and which provided that there would be no one factor that was more important than all the other factors in the statute. The other problem with the legislation is that it assumes that by creating a presumption in favor of joint physical custody on an equal basis, that this would be the appropriate custody arrangement in the vast majority of cases, and that is only inappropriate in cases where a parent is otherwise unfit to a degree that they would cause substantial harm to a child. This is fallacious, and there are many reasons why a 50-50 arrangement might be inappropriate other than unfitness. Cases involving domestic abuse, cases involving high conflict between parents, cases in which there are great distances between different parents' residences, cases in which one of the parents has a personality disorder or some form of mental illness, cases where there is a lack of flexibility in one parent's work schedule that prevents them from being able to provide the type of parenting time that would otherwise be the case. The age of a child and a child's ability to tolerate an equal access arrangement. And here's an important one, the level of parental involvement with the child prior to the particular family court proceeding. As I read this legislation, if a parent had no contact with a child for, let's say, the first 15 years of a child's life, for whatever reason, be it a paternity case or just the parent was just not around, that parent would be entitled to the same presumption in favor of equal parenting time as a parent that had been completely and totally involved on an equal basis prior to the start of the divorce proceeding. So I see this legislation as having a cure that's worse than whatever disorder that is out there. And as I heard the study that Ms. Olson was testifying about previously, along with the gentleman who was testifying about it, more and more, according to this study, people are entering into arrangements for substantial parenting time. And I think, if I didn't hear it correctly, I'm sorry, but I thought I heard that in 40% of the cases, they found that the parents had 45.1% plus parenting time, and that in 70% of the cases, there was approximately 30%, at least 30% parenting time. So it seems to me that what the question needs to be, what is it about those cases in which the parent had less than 25% parenting time that such parenting time was awarded, or less than 45.1% parenting time? I would hazard a guess that in those particular cases, it probably had to do more with the age of the child and whether or not the parents followed a more traditional model of child rearing prior to the start of the legal proceeding. I think that I would advise the committee to take a look at the memo from Karen Irvin. It's one of the handouts, her memo dated February 4th, 2011. She alludes to, in her memo, a research that was done by Dr. Jennifer McIntosh, who's from Australia, where they did experiencing a legislative imposed presumption in favor of joint physical custody. In that case, I think that the level that was presumed was a parenting time level of 35%, which was, in their opinion, equivalent to shared parenting. And she found that in this study that there was a negative impact, especially on young children under the age of 4 years. So there is actually people that have done this before, and I haven't heard any kind of testimony about state legislatures from other states that have adopted this type of legislation and its impact upon people going through the court system, but I would strongly urge you to think twice before adopting a presumption in favor of equal access. I think that by imposing this, it's going to create a lot of problems. It's going to encourage fault-based litigation over custody, and it's going to have deleterious impacts on children. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Dittmerner. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Dittmerner. To start off with, Mr. Dittmerner, you are the legislative chair of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers.
Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers.
Okay, thank you. So, Mr. Dittmerner, would it be safe to say or accurate to say that people in your profession have a vested interest in this bill?
I wouldn't say that. If what you mean, will we benefit by this bill not being adopted financially? No.
Okay.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Dittmerner, do you believe that if this bill was passed, would it decrease or let me back up. Realizing, you seem to believe that, and I've heard that before, but I don't know exactly where it's founded, that there would be an increase in court activity if this bill was passed. If you look at, and I don't know if you have the bill in front of you, Mr. Dittmerner, but line 8.14, the standard is clear and convincing evidence. And I guess I could understand your concern if there was a lower standard than that. It seems to be a very high standard, which may provide deterrent, I would expect, from court activity. But given those realities, do you expect the bill will increase or decrease the your profession's involvement in litigating cases?
I think that it will more than likely increase our involvement in litigating cases because more people are going to be contesting custody awards. And if they're going to be contesting an equal presumption of parenting time, I think a good example would be the gentleman that testified before me, where his ex-wife is in a parenting time situation where, or work situation where her work schedule is too inflexible. And so there are going to be people that are going to, I think, try to demonstrate why, by clear and convincing evidence, there should not be equal parenting time. And they will be hiring lawyers to do that. And these cases will be relatively nasty because it'll be an effort to prove that the other parent is unfit. Now, I lived through the primary caretaker presumption era when I was a young attorney first starting out practicing law. And that's basically what happened as a result of that Supreme Court decision that was later legislatively overturned. Basically, people were reduced to basically who's the more awful parent. And that's what this legislation invites us to do.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you think the lawsuits on inflexibility will be any uglier than the lawsuits today? More rhetorical than anything else.
I would say that, yeah, because there's going to be a lot more situations in which joint physical custody is being attempted to be imposed, or I should say equal parenting time is attempted to be imposed on situations that are not appropriate for it, such as the example that I gave you of somebody that has not been involved in a child's life for 15 years. And all of a sudden they're saying that, hey, I have this presumption. And litigation.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
And you know, that is certainly a viable opinion. I think I would disagree. I don't know that if someone's been uninvolved for 15 years, they're all of a sudden going to come out of the woodwork and say, I want to be involved, except in the rare case where they weren't aware of the child or something of that nature. But that really isn't my question. You know, this is not the first time this particular issue has come up. Have you or your organization ever contacted any of the past or previous authors with suggestions on how to address this particular issue other than just to leave the law alone?
I believe,
and be careful, I've been the author every time for the last 8 years.
Mr. Chair,
there is a Senate Representative Mahoney.
Representative Mahoney, I do believe that some lawyers, maybe not necessarily from our organization, have talked with state legislators about trying to address some of these issues with regard to joint physical custody by having a less draconian type of presumption imposed legislatively. One of them being stating specifically that there is no presumption against joint physical custody. And also attempting to legislatively deal with the problem in some counties, maybe it's one county, where people have to get some kind of approval, special super approval, of a joint physical custody arrangement that they've agreed to. So I believe that there are family law attorneys who have attempted to work with state legislators to try to come up with a more moderate type of approach that helps to solve the problem.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
That presumption was overturned after the physical custody study that was done 2 years ago, and it was rather shocking that most of the people on that committee, many of them judges, I think there were two judges and numerous lawyers, did not realize that that presumption was still in law. So, yes, I know, I overturned that particular, I put the law into effect that, or passed that law that took that out. But I want to refer back to your study, the Australian study, because I went to the William Mitchell Law School seminar on that particular study. I sat through almost the whole thing and sat through the video presentation of the author of the study. And I was, you know, it was a study for the first 30 or 40 or 50 minutes, which I thought was just fine. It talked about what happened in Australia. But I was shocked that towards the end, when I started to understand what the presenter was saying, which was that children under a certain age should not be in anyone else's care other than the mother. And actually, I was very shocked when I read that, or heard that. So I went back and made the mistake of actually reading the whole study. And if you read studies, you can understand my sarcasm there. And in the end, if you look through the study, it's not those exact words, but it comes out that children under the age of 3, and particularly infants under the age of 1, should never be separated from their mother. I think there's 70% of the workforce in America that would maybe like that, but probably can't do that. As a divorced father who took care of his infant daughter, I would be offended at that, and I was. So what is your thoughts on infants being separated from their mother in a divorce case when the judge orders a 30-70 or a 25%?
Mr.
Chair, Representative Mahoney, I believe that it depends upon the level of parental involvement in terms of the child rearing prior to when the proceeding takes place, and that the court really needs to focus on that. I don't think age alone is an issue. It's certainly one of the factors that one looks to in trying to deem what's an appropriate arrangement, because it can have more negative effects on younger children, whereas older children, the effects are perhaps less negative, assuming you don't have a high conflict type of situation. So that's really, to me, you know, what's the nature of the child? Is the child able to deal with more frequent transfers between the two parents? And what's the level of the parental involvement by both parents prior to the start of the proceeding? But, of course, that's not dealt with or addressed in this legislation. It's a simple presumption in favor of equal parenting time.
Mr. Chair, one last question.
Representative Mahoney and then Representative Holbert.
One of the things that stands out in this bill, and I've heard over the several years that I've carried the bill, there's a complaint about judges and their written findings. And this bill talks about detailed findings, and mostly anecdotal. I give you that. But could you give the committee either your thoughts or your organization's thoughts on requiring judges to actually write the findings themselves without using the words of the evaluator or the guardian ad litem, so that if there is a reason to go back and talk to a different judge or whatever, the litigant would have why they were not given 50-50 time?
Mr. Dittmerner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I would agree that it would be helpful that when a judicial officer is making a decision regarding a custody award, that they do explain why they favored a particular arrangement over another. Part of the problem is that it's attorneys who send proposed findings to the judge, and if the attorney has articulated their own spin on why it should happen, and you might have a judge that does not talk a lot about why they made a particular award, that can be incredibly frustrating, I think, for a client who's undergoing that type of process. I think that often it's helpful when judges, even getting beyond the issue of findings, will at least attach perhaps a memorandum where they sort of like summarize their opinion and discuss how they reached their conclusion. And I think that that would be far more preferable. But I should also note that the vast majority of cases are settled. It is rare cases that actually go to litigation. Cases that go to litigation, it's been my experience, by and large, are high conflict situations where at least one of the parties tends to have what we call a personality disorder. It's not a form of mental illness, but it's a personality disorder that impacts their ability to have self-awareness and appreciate the impact on their choices on their children and on their former spouse. And those are really what the problem is today, by and large, left. We're able to settle a lot of these cases. We have early neutral evaluations and initial case management conferences at which a lot of the cases that otherwise would have gone to trial are being settled, and that's an initiative that began in Hennepin County. But it's these other cases, the high conflict cases, that we're always plagued with, and we probably will continue to have issues and problems with. And that's a question of needing to have more resources so that there can be independent, neutral information being provided to the court about what is in the best interests of children. And a lot of the court system has had to deal with a decline of judicial resources and custody evaluators. There's less and less counties across the state that have custody evaluators that provide neutral opinion to the court. And as a result, you have litigation being waged without any type of neutral observer providing this information to the court. And I think that that's a huge negative, and it's something that perhaps the policymakers really need to look at seriously.
Thank you.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my questions are not for the current testifier, but either for the bill author or Ms. Ayers, and I'm not sure which, so I don't know if we're at that
point
yet.
We're soon to that point, Representative Holbert. Representative Drazkowski, is there your question to this?
It is, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
And we'll go to Representative Drazkowski. Then Representative Holbert, there is five others that have asked to testify, given we are well within the 90 minutes of the opponents. My intention would be to give each of them a few minutes, but if you want to ask a question before that, that's.
And Mr. Chair, I don't know what your intent is for this bill. I think there's some pretty serious issues with the way the bill is written. I'd like to support this policy. It sounds good, but I would hope that we would have some substantial time for committee discussion and then time for the bill authors to look at maybe revisions. So I don't know if you're trying to get this finished in the next committee hearing or what your issues are.
I don't know yet, Representative Holberg, and that's let's have Representative Drazkowski ask, and then I would encourage you to – I'll come back to you, and then we can have the witnesses, because maybe your questions will spur some response and answers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dibberner, I was intrigued by your discussion about the theory that those cases that go to trial, even though they're a small number, involve some sort of personality disorder, and was very interested in that discussion. I am one who did go to trial, and I don't believe my ex-wife has a personality disorder, so I'm kind of I think either we're the exception, or maybe your theory might be a little bit off. But could it be that that simply the parents love their kids so much they're willing to spend everything they have and don't have in order to keep them,
Mr. Dittmerner?
Keep access to them,
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski. Obviously, I can't speak to your situation. I just can tell you from my experience and what my observations have been in terms of the type of cases that I have seen litigated. And, you know, I think certainly a case that may go to trial where somebody really loves their child and wants to have parenting time but is prevented perhaps or is objected to by their spouse. That's truly an outcome that they believe is appropriate in that case. And I'm not going to begrudge them that option if that's what they decide to go ahead and do. But I think that a lot of the problem, I think, is with people basically not being able to appreciate the impact of their decisions on their children and on their spouse. And I think that that's a problem that faces a lot of these situations.
Mr. Chair, one last question.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Dipperner, I keep going back to your assertion that you believe that there's going to be more court activity because of the passage of this type of policy. Again, I draw your attention to the fact that the way the bill is written has clear and convincing evidence. I think about that in contrast to the current system we have, which is basically the 13 best interest factors for children, and the judge basically does not have a standard of anything close to the clear and convincing evidence standard in the height that it contains. how can you have that? I don't know how you can come to that conclusion given that contrast.
Mr. Chair, Representative Raskowski, you know, I can tell you what my experience was during the Pakula era, and that was where we were battling over who was fit or not. And when I see a standard for rebuttal of a presumption that mentions parental unfitness, all I can tell you is I see a return to those days, fault-based custody litigation, and it's a day that I would rather not go back to, even if it were to be more financially profitable for me or for other family law attorneys. But that's the direction that I see it headed into if we have this type of standard adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Ditmerner. Members, there's five parties, one that we didn't get to on the proponents, and four that have asked during this hearing to testify. What I'm going to do is ask them to take 3 minutes or less each. We've got about 40 minutes left of the opponents' 90 minutes. And so, Representative Holberg, what I'd like to do is have those individuals come up, and then I would like to get into the committee discussion or questions for witnesses. We'll have these. Mr. Mike Sieber first, and Anthony Hubert, you're next if you want to get ready. Tom Ruby will be after that.
Thank you very much. I'm Michael Sieber. I want to thank Steve Druskowski, Peggy Scott, Molly Olson, Tim Mahoney. I'm a big supporter of this bill and shared parenting. I've been in the trenches a long time. I've heard hundreds of these stories, like we heard tonight, these tragic stories. I've been around so long that's no wonder I feel moldy and rusty. 12 years now. But like Billy Crystal said in Mr. Saturday Night, don't get me started. I'm trying to be brief here and succinct, so I'm going to skip through some of my notes. I believe I'm qualified to state as a fact the current system is broken and broken badly. I don't think any of us are going to question that. And I didn't want to take time to rebut Mr. Ditmerner, but I'm not sure if he didn't rebut himself on some of the things. He doesn't want parents to fight over 45.1% of the time, and he doesn't want labels, and he thinks they're going to fight more over this stuff, but I think they're fighting more now when virtually all of their time and a lot of money is being taken from them, and I think this is a little more balanced to the equation, so I won't spend any more time on that. Insanity is doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results. Albert Einstein said that. I don't think even our opposition can honestly say that we currently have sane and sound public policy relating to families that is constitutionally compliant. I haven't heard a lot of talk tonight about something that I want to bring to the table. And I do think this bill will return a little bit of sanity and at least a minimum of constitutionality to family law. Why has family law gone wrong? How can we fix it? This is how we can fix it. And I want to make sure that everybody in this room understands that the only purpose of government, the only authority it has, is to protect God-given individual rights, to protect our God-given individual rights. Every law must conform to this principle. Sadly, most don't. Certainly not in family court. What you have to decide is this question. Under what circumstances and by what authority will the police power of the state be used to take a child away from a parent? Answer: a parental rights termination hearing in a court of law with a jury under a strict scrutiny evidentiary standard. Mr. Ditmerner's objected to this bill. And there was another objection to it, but I believe the purpose of this is to level the playing field And when either parent realizes that they're not going to lose everything, time or money, especially time, then they will easily be able to come to an agreement. And one might take a little more time, one will take a little less time. If he doesn't want people to fight over labels or time or money or anything, let's eliminate child support. I think we're selling ourselves a little short here, and I think we need to go a lot further. Basically,
that's 3 minutes. Just if you can wrap up. And
okay, thank you. Like I said, don't get me started. You can't split the child, so you have to split the time. And I'll just leave you with this, and this will be very brief. We have to comply with the law of the land. Okay, the law of the land is as follows. Parents are presumed fit, and fit parents are presumed to act in the best interests of their children until proven otherwise. And it's been said before that the parent-child relationship is a fundamental right. So, in support of the bill, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Sieber. Anthony Huber, welcome to the committee. Can you offer testimony in 3 minutes or less?
I hope so.
Identify yourself for the record, please. I'll give you
my name is Anthony
minute
Huber. I'm here in support of joint physical custody. I'm an unmarried dad in Anoka County. I was verbally, emotionally, and physically abused by my co-parent and had to deal with the constant threats of her fleeing with our son before he was born, through birth, and then after. When she was pregnant, she would inform me by saying that by law, I don't have to let you see your son. By law, you have no rights. I can keep you away from your son. There's nothing you can do. By law, I can leave and you can never see your unborn son. And then after our son was born, the threats changed. I can take him away and there's nothing you can do about it until the courts get involved and mothers always win. All I have to do is call the police and they'll take you away. You'll never see your son again. I don't have to let you see him. It's none of your business where he is. During the day, you're lucky I let you see him at all. My son's 3 and a half. We have an awesome father-son bond now, thank God. But it was a tough road. From the time our son was born in September to January 10th of the next year, I was his full-time primary caregiver, and I worked at home and was able to care for my son before and after she returned to work. I designed a schedule, and Mom helped when she got home. On January 10th, our son was 5 months old. My co-parent came home. She was very, very hostile, telling me she was leaving and I was never going to see my son again and I had no rights. I was just the sperm donor. She was hostile. With our son in my arms, I locked myself into the corner of a room and called the Fridley police not once but twice, begging them to come back, begging them to come as quickly as they could while she was forcing her way into the room that we were in. And the dispatch asked if I was okay. I said no. She knew that my son and I were in danger. And she rushed the police. They came in and talked with her, and they told her, by law, she could leave, and there was nothing that I could do. We weren't married. She didn't have to let me see my son. So she took that as law, and she let me see my son a couple times for the next couple of months. And
1 minute.
She hit him up in a daycare that was unlicensed and refused to let me see this. This third-party daycare provider had more rights to my son than I did. She lied about being licensed, bonded, and insured. Hennepin County shut her down. Anoka County, I was reprimanded by the judge for having this daycare provider not shut down because it wasn't up to me, but inquiring about whether or not she was telling me the truth about being licensed and insured. I lost parenting time immediately because of that, and I lost joint legal custody. My son lives with a two-time violent felon who blew two UAs during the custody evaluation, and the custody evaluator put in her report to the judge that my son should have immediately no contact with this gentleman. I don't have a criminal history at all. I don't have a drug or alcohol history at all. There's nothing. There's nothing that should keep my son and I away from each other, except for the laws that say that unmarried fathers don't have any rights. And that needs to be changed. And I'm certainly for changing and at least reevaluating, the situation. Somebody suggested that children under the age of one shouldn't spend not but a couple hours without their mother. That's absolutely ridiculous. I raised my son from the time that he was born up until now, and I've done a terrific job. And there's lots of fathers that do it all the time. There's lots of mothers that do it other. And one parent's not better over the other just because of their gender.
Thank you, Mr. Huber. Thank you for coming in. Two more. Tom Ruby.
Hello.
Welcome. Can you stay within 3 minutes, preferably? Please do, and I'll give you a minute warning and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Tom Ruby. I'm the divorced father of a beautiful daughter who is now in the fourth grade, and I'd like to testify in support of this bill. My court case has been going on for 9 years with still no final resolution. There are no property disagreements. The sole issue is custody of our daughter. My ex-wife wanted sole custody while I asked for joint physical custody. My ex-wife had no complaints about my parenting, only that she didn't want to cooperate with me. Nothing bad has been said about my parenting, no domestic violence, no neglect or abuse, or anything remotely related. My case so far has included 2 trials, 3 trips to the appellate court, and 1 trip to the Minnesota Supreme Court. On the initial custody evaluation for the 13 best interest factors, 12 were declared equal, and the recommendation hinged on the county evaluator on the 13th factor, which was which parent is most likely to include the other parent in the child's life. It did not explain why, if my ex-wife was more willing to include me, then why was she the one insisting on sole physical custody? 6 weeks after the initial judgment that was later overturned, my ex-wife demonstrated this willingness to include me by moving 25 miles away. The initial judgment also made me responsible for all transportation and related costs. I've done my best to stay involved in my daughter's life, even though I was given the standard Wednesday nights and every other weekend. I've served on the local ECFE Advisory Council, coached her soccer teams, taught art adventure classes at her local school, served to help plan the daddy-daughter dance. I was even asked to be one of the 5 parents to serve on her elementary school site council, even though I didn't even live in the district. While I think I've managed to stay involved in my daughter's life, this is in spite of the family law system rather than encouraged by it. There are many parents in Minnesota who successfully co-parent and share custody after a divorce. But if you speak with them, you learn that once again is in spite of the family law system rather than because of it. As my daughter gets older, it becomes harder for a non-custodial parent to stay involved, and I live in constant fear of being edged out of my daughter's life. All of this has cost me over $150,000 in legal fees. I'm sure the Bar Association will oppose this bill, as they have, but their motivation for opposition is strictly a financial one. I'm not an attorney, but I am an economist, and $150,000 in fees is ample profit motive for the Bar Association to oppose any reform. I've never been arrested or accused of a crime. I've never been sued or sued anyone. My sole experience with the judicial system comes from my family court experiences. Having been to many of these hearings before, there's been a reluctance among legislators to get involved in family law issues. For law-abiding citizens, these family law issues have the greatest impact on our opinions with the judiciary and government. Having been involved with this issue for several years, what becomes most frustrating at the policy level is the shell game played between the legislature and the judiciary. Legislators will say it's an independent judiciary and it is the judges who are making these determinations, while the judges will claim that they are bound by statute and it is up to the legislature if changes are needed. I urge you to find the decisions, look at the decisions that they're making in your name. I only want to be treated as and recognized as an equal parent and have the judicial and family law system help foster the parent-child relationship instead of obstruct and hinder it. There are over 250,000 non-custodial parents in Minnesota. Adding in grandparents, second spouses, and grown children of divorce, this issue probably affects over 1 million Minnesotans. While no story is the same, that is the point. The cookie-cutter decisions, and by that I mean the every other weekend and Wednesdays, that are doled out under the current law, don't take into account different circumstances, and they only serve to harm the children that they are supposed to protect. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ruby. Two more. I misspoke last time. There was 2 left after Mr. Mm-hmm. Ruby. It's Chad Barthelme and then Rick Heller. Rick, if you want to be ready after Chad, Chad, please come forward. Welcome to the committee. If you can identify yourself for the record, and 3 minutes, I'll give you a minute warning, and if you can stay within that, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Chad Bartholomew. I was the other proponent on the 2008 study group for the presumption of joint physical custody, along with Molly Olson. I just want to say a few things to clarify what I perceive are the opponent's primary suggestions as to why this presumption is not a good thing to do. Foremost, I think everybody, even the opponents, do suggest that shared custody is in the best interest of the children. However, they will suggest that there's exceptions to that, and then they'll bring out points that try to suggest that those exceptions are more normative than I think the reality is. One of the main arguments they'll make is the presumption will remove the court's ability to treat cases on an individual basis. I think every single non-custodial parent here would argue that's exactly what failed in their system, is that they were not allowed to be treated as an individual human being, as an individual parent, and measured on their own merits as a person and as a parent. And so the presumption does the exact opposite of what the opponents are saying. It won't allow the courts to do. It will allow the courts, to treat cases on an individual basis, perhaps for the first time. The other primary contention that the opponents will suggest that why the presumption is a bad scenario is because of conflict, that high conflict situations are detrimental to the children. Obviously, that is the case, and I would argue, and I believe every parent that's here as a non-custodial parent would say, it's the court process itself that has caused the conflict, that the establishment of a win-lose scenario breeds the conflict itself, that without equality, you're going to have conflict. I think anybody who understands anything about conflict resolution understands that establishing a power differential is in itself an impediment to resolving conflict as well as an establishment of conflict. Equality is necessary as a precursor to resolving conflict. Solution to conflict after that is counseling and, getting the parents to effectively co-parent through coursework or whatever. It's not establishing a permanent power differential between the parents. That's all I wanted to add, and thank you for your time.
One minute. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Rick Heller.
Rick Heller speaking for the bill, but some concerns within it.
Can you stay within 3 minutes, Rick?
Yes, I shall.
Please proceed.
If you go to 218, where it talks about, first of all, physical custody and residence being struck through under, again, page 2, line 18. If you look in the education piece, how that fits in that, you might want to look at that, how that component fits into that. That's an important piece, the consideration. If anybody knows anything about education, you'll find that out. I don't have those statutes in front of me. Also, on page 814, briefly, line 14 under fitness. I was glad back in 1997 to go to co-parenting. As everybody knows, historically, the courts had ordered that parents go to co-parenting classes to get on the same page for developing a plan for proceedings of divorce. Unfortunately, I found out when I got to court that those plans were mandatory to have, and I think that's an important piece regarding that. As far as that's one of the reasons I agree with that. The other piece is I did not choose to basically have a fitness determination as line 814, because basically it degrades both parents, and I don't think that's appropriate. If you're working through a solution and let a third party decide. So I guess you got to walk away even if you are wrong. It takes sometimes more of a man to do that. As far as the 4.5% falling on the same page on 810, one thing you need to consider about a concern is, do men breastfeed their children? Frankly, they do not. Younger children definitely are an important component and how they bond to their mother. I don't know how this bill will look at that in a meaningful way. But again, that's about it, Lyle. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Members, Representative Holberg, I'll come back to you if you want to
thank you.
Generate some discussion. And my plan would be to be out no later than 9:15, and we can continue it later. That would be 3 hours from when we started, and it's we'll try to adjourn by then, if not sooner.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your indulgence here. This sounds good. This has been around for a long time, and joint physical custody sounds good. You want to make it to work. And as a legislator, these are the most difficult issues that we face in our offices. When constituents call us with family law problems, we can't go tell the judges what to do. There he said, she said, we have no opportunity to do an investigation to find out who's right, who's wrong. They're emotional. It involves children. They're the most challenging and least fun, at least for me, part of being a legislator. And so, I mean, I like the idea of joint physical custody. It makes sense. And the authors of and the people working on this bill have come and met with me, and I appreciate that. And I was supposed to be at three other places tonight, but I really care about this issue, and I'm trying to do the right thing here. And as I look at this bill, I'm going to ask some questions, and I don't know how many of you in the audience have actually read the entire bill, but as I ask these questions, you may want to put yourself on the other side of the fence. And if you had custody or sole custody of your children, would these standards be high enough for you to want to go into a shared custody model? But first of all, the definition that you guys in the bill for a chemically dependent person is under the civil commitment statute and requires a number of conditions to be met. And the bill contains a clear and convincing standard. And I'm curious, how would you ever accomplish that given HIPAA and privacy laws? How could you find out that somebody met this high standard of chemical dependency, let alone somebody, as most of us know, a high component of chemical dependency is denial and, you know, hiding and all kinds of stuff that's really not clear and convincing, even to the most skilled evaluators, on whether or not people need help or treatment. So I don't know if this is a question for Ms. Ayers or the bill authors, but how do you ever get to that clear and convincing standard of a definition of chemical dependency, given most health records are private and inaccessible, and also the nature of chemical dependency?
Representative Scott, you want to start with that?
I think I would defer to our House research on that. I'm not an attorney, and she is.
Ms. Aves?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I am not sure what evidence the court would ask for. I'm assuming that if a person had been committed or detained under that statute, that would be enough. And I believe that is what that language was intended to mean, that the person had to be displaying the behaviors that would result in the commitment.
Okay, so just to be clear, so in order for an issue of chemical dependency to rise to a clear and convincing standard, it would have to rise to the level of that individual being in a same evaluation be subject to a civil commitment?
Yes.
All right, and just I think that's a pretty high standard for anybody to meet. And then as I look, I'm kind of going in on page 8, lines 18 to 26. And then then it looks that you need to have clear and convincing evidence, and this is on line 21, that the parents' behaviors would qualify the parent's child to be found in need of protection of services under 260C.007, which is the child protection standard. And the two subdivisions that are referenced are subdivision 13, which is domestic child abuse. I think we can all agree that if, you know, I don't even know that I'd go to clear and convincing, but child abuse, we should be able to take a look at. Because the way I read this, that if you don't make this threshold, you don't get to the best interest standard. You got to get past this threshold. So, okay. And then subdivision 14, you don't include. But I just want to read for people what's included in subdivision 14 that's not included in your bill, so can't be considered. And that's agrarious harm, which means the infliction of bodily harm to a child or neglect of a child, which demonstrates a grossly inadequate ability to provide minimally adequate parental care, and the harm need not have occurred in the state. And then it goes on to list 10 different things, and these things include a violation of various sections, substantial bodily harm, felony malicious punishment of a child, felony unreasonable restraint of a child, felony neglect or endangerment of a child, conduct towards a child that constitutes assault, conduct towards a child that constitutes solicitation, inducement, or promotion of or receiving profit derived from prostitution, conduct that constitutes murder or voluntary manslaughter, conduct towards a child that constitutes aiding or abetting, attempting, conspiring, or soliciting to commit a murder or voluntary manslaughter, and you haven't referenced that as behavior standards that would, clear and convincing evidence, undo the presumption of shared parenting. And it may have been an oversight, but that concerns me. And like I said, this system doesn't work. I agree with all of you that have testified. But if you believe that you want this bill to become law, and you had the kids, and your ex was coming in under this law with a presumption of 45% parenting, and had been, let's say, because it's clear and convincing, had been convicted of conduct under these sections, the judge wouldn't be able to use that to determine a reduction in parenting time as I read this bill. Is that correct?
Representative Scott, any comment? Or Ms. Aves?
I don't remember when we did this section of the bill why we wouldn't have included 14. I don't know if Ms. Aves recalls or not, Mr. Chair, but I don't see any reason why that
Ms. Aves.
Couldn't be added.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I don't know why that was not included.
Okay. So that concerns me. And I hope it concerns everybody in this room that's come up here to say please vote for this bill, because we got to fix that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
We'd definitely be willing to add that.
And so then, as I look at this, it says, in no instance may the court limit parent and child contact upon absent compelling necessity to prevent substantial and imminent harm to the child. And I'm not a lawyer. I know certain things are defined in code. Is the term substantial or imminent defined in code?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg.
Ms. Aves.
I'm not sure it may be defined in the child protection standards, but I would have to look that up and see. I believe it's probably defined in court cases.
Because, I mean, at the very least, in at least the way I look at this, I don't like the and. It should be or, because I don't really care if it's substantial but not imminent, and I don't really care if it's not imminent. I mean, it's substantial and imminent is a pretty high standard on a clear and convincing proof standard to get to. And then all of this, you got to get past all of this before you go to the best interest of the child. And Representative Mahoney, when we had our initial conversations, I was more focused on the lack of, in situations where there was a lack of establishment of any type of relationship, and that this presumption, again, unless you can prove those things, and there was some testimony about the child's 15 years old, paternity was established at the time of birth, one of the parents moves away, shows up 15 years later, and you start looking at these kinds of standards, I think it would be very hard for a judge to get to the best interest of the child standard, and in fact would be compelled to provide the shared parent or the joint custody model with the shared parenting standard, because you can't get into the best interest of the child unless you can prove an individual who's been missing in action for 15 years falls into one of these standards. And I just don't think that that's good for kids. And do I want kids to have relationships with both parents? You bet I do. But kids need to be safe, and we need to make sure that these standards are workable, and words have meaning, and judges have to follow what we say here. And when we don't even call out prostitution or murder as a standard, it may be an oversight, and you know, I can understand that, but and that's why kind of my question to the chair, and that how, what's the process of this bill? These things take time. I don't know how many years Chair Smith worked on the remodel of how you paid child support. I think it was 5 years, and I certainly don't want to take this much time on this issue, but and I understand the frustration, but there has to be some ability for the court to take in the big picture here and the best interest standards of the children. We've had people talk here about that, you know, they qualified as even on 12 or whatever, and is that a great way to do this? I don't know, but I think that the hurdles in this bill leave behind what are the best needs of kids sometimes, because they're so high. And an attorney here can remind me what clear and convincing is as opposed to a preponderance, but I think it's like, what, over 95% or something. I mean, it's really high. And I know as a legislator, and spending time, I've sat in coffee shops with individuals, I've read volumes of letters and documents and police reports. I don't know that I could ever get to a clear and convincing standard spending a lot of time with individuals in very contentious situations. Maybe judges can do it the way judges operate. I don't know. But we can't set up a standard where the parent's always first and the kid's second either. And I think, I do think that there has to be more consideration. I think about issues like, do both parents have a crib? Do both parents have a home that's free of other individuals that may provide harm to a child or not? Do both individuals have stability? And unless you can prove that there's some type of convincing, substantial, and imminent harm to the child, you don't get to any of those other things. You only get to the presumption of joint physical custody. And so, again, I want to support this. This sounds good. We need reforms. But I think that there's more work to do. And I know, Representative Scott, it's not your intent to set up a situation where people that put their kids out for prostitution or murder or whatever, that wasn't your intent. But words matter, and we can all come here and testify for hours and hours and say vote for this bill. But let's spend some really good time looking at how we can make important, relevant changes to this really contentious, horrible situation without inadvertent consequences. And I don't need any answers at this point. I just want to put out there that there's some problems we can work on.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Holbert brings forth some really good questions. Some of them, I think, are covered in some of the amendments and stuff that were offered. Others are not. Some of them, what she brought up about Section 14 being omitted is very valid. And our intent here is to make this the best bill that we can make it for the kids in our state, so that they're getting a fair shake. And we in no way would ever want to put any of them in harm's way, or a mother or anybody else in harm's way. So what I've said before, and I'll say it again, we're willing to, this is a work in progress, and we're willing to make, you know, we're willing to meet with whoever wants to meet with us and work on this and hammer out the fine details.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. First, Representative Holberg, that's exactly, you've raised some of the good issues, and that's the reason we want to hold hearings.
Well,
if it's done in a week, great. If it's done in a month, fine. If it's not never done because your issues can't get resolved, that's fine too.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I don't think that the bill author and I are far apart in what we want to accomplish. I mean, I know Representative Scott, and I know she cares about kids and families as much as anybody at this table does. But we have to be really, really careful when we dabble in this area. Well, words matter, and in particular in family law, it's kids' lives, it's parents' lives, and with consequences. And I'll reiterate, I think the system has major problems that need to be fixed. I'm not turning my head to that issue at all. But I don't think by Monday we're going to be ready to vote on this bill. Let me just say
Are you
that.
Clear and convinced of that, Representative Holberg?
I think so, although I'm not sure what percent that is.
You've got to stand it on the system has a problem.
Yeah, and I agree. I'm not an attorney. I'm kind of slower than the average bear. It takes me a while to digest this stuff, and that's why I wanted to sit and listen tonight and read everything. And as I sat here and put all the pieces together, I have some major concerns.
Representative Mahoney, then Hillstrom, then Hilty, and then we might wrap up.
No, I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holberg said it quite well, and I look forward to continued discussion on this issue.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had originally thought I would just defer my question or concern until we took this bill up on Monday, but Representative Holberg did hit exactly one of my concerns, although she did not mention that specifically. And I'm wondering, is there a definition in law or in this bill that I'm missing of what actually constitutes harm?
Ms. Aves, do you know that offhand?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, I do not believe there is a definition of harm in this bill. And there, harm is defined in different ways in the statute depending on the situation. In child protection matters, it's defined one way, and it's defined in the child welfare statutes. There's no cross-reference in this bill to that definition.
Mr. Chair, members, this is one of the things that struck me in reading this bill initially, and certainly it occurs to me, and from my experience with any number of people, there's a multitude of situations in which harm can occur and of varying kinds. What seems to be implied in this bill is that it's physical harm, but it seems to me that more often than an occurrence of physical harm is an occurrence of some kind of profound psychological harm. And I don't know if we're getting at that. I don't know what the author's intention is. But it does seem to me that there should be some kind of indication in the bill of what we mean by that, because I could see that as a major point of contention.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm certainly willing to look at that definition too and get the appropriate word, appropriate definition for harm there.
Representative Joskowski, then Simon, and then we'll adjourn. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, I share the thoughts that Representative Holberg had around making certain that we have the provisions in that 8.22 to 8.24 area to make sure we don't have areas that we missed. But I would add that the bill does not have provisions right now for modifications for those people who may have already gone through a process and have a court order of some sort. So the whole 15-year scenario that was laid out by the individual earlier, I don't know that it applies. I would expect in 15 years or 15 months or however long it would be, that most time those people are going to have some sort of court custody order around that. I know that, Representative Holberg, you were talking about the whole thing about, you know, is the government going to have a chance to see if the parents both have cribs and if they both have all the necessities. You know, we're kind of starting to dance around that whole question that, and I guess that's the ridge of the hilltop that we walk along here, but of do we to what level do we assume that both parents, and there was some testimony before, come into the thing having both been parents before they even got to court, of being fit people to begin with, absent us proving otherwise. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, to that point, right now in the state of Minnesota, if there is an unmarried woman that has a child, unless there's been a court order, they have joint physical and legal custody. So the scenario of somebody coming in a number of years later and demanding an equal parenting time, and unless you met the standard for denial, whatever it is, the judge would be compelled to give that standard. So you could have a 10 or 12-year-old child that had never had any contact whatsoever with one of their parents, and under the bill as it's written, that would never be taken into consideration. Unless you could prove that they were under the sections that we discussed. Otherwise, there'd be no modification. It would be a minimum of 45%. And I'm not so sure we want 10 or 12-year-olds all of a sudden being forced to spend 45% of their time with somebody they don't even know.
Representative Simon. Representative Druskowski.
Mr. Chair, to that point, Representative Holbrook, could you say that again? So if there are two unmarried parents, then the mother would have automatically joint legal and physical custody? Is that what I heard?
Yeah, current law, unmarried mothers have sole joint physical and legal custody unless there's a court order otherwise.
Okay. So...
So 15 years later, in this instance, a dad could come under this bill, and if they didn't fall under the clear and convincing standard of 1315, it was substantial imminent bodily harm, the court would be compelled to award physical custody of at least 45% upon that motion to have custody.
Thank you.
Representative Simon.
Thanks. I know I'm standing between everyone and adjournment, so
that's all right.
I'll try to be quick. I just want to, this has been, to me, really fascinating, and I want to thank Representative Scott and everyone who came here tonight. This is raw stuff. I mean, no question about it. I'm not a family lawyer, and for good reason, because I think the folks who go into family law really have my respect, because they're seeing people at their rawest, at their most emotional, sometimes their most fragile. And that's very different than most other lawyers, certainly my law practice, and I bet Representative Wardlow's and others in this room as well. So hats off to the folks who do this for a living. And it's difficult stuff, and for those of you who have been through the system, hats off to you for coming in here and expressing your viewpoints. One quick observation and then a couple quick questions. I heard a couple testifiers mentioned that there was a current presumption against physical custody, a joint physical custody. My reading is different. In the law that's being repealed, 518.17, I'm reading here that it says the court shall use a rebuttable presumption that joint legal or physical custody is not in the best interests of the child if domestic abuse as defined in section 518b.01 has occurred. What I'm reading, and someone can correct me if I'm wrong, is there's no presumption, legal presumption, against joint physical custody unless this circumstance exists, unless there's domestic abuse. Am I missing that?
Representative Mahoney, you have some insight.
Yes. I believe it was 2 years ago after the joint physical custody study that was changed. Now, I'd have to look in the statute book to see the year that it was changed, but it has been changed just recently.
Ms. Aves, do you have any input on it?
To get taking away that presumption. We clarified it in law.
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Aves?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
No.
Something we could get?
Yes, I can check.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm just looking at the repealer on the back of what we've been handed here, and what we're
repealing.
Right. What I read is law. Right. Presumably current law because we're repealing it, but I'm sure we can come up with an answer to that. Just a couple quick questions, and they will be quick. One is, in looking over the language here, I was trying to figure out what the standard was, and I couldn't really, in terms of modifications of existing orders, not new, fresh orders or decrees regarding custody, but if someone's going in to modify an existing order, and either Representative Scott or any of the proponents, could you explain how that works? Would these same standards apply, or is it a different standard?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Scott.
We felt that if we put language in here that would allow modifications right now, that the court system would be flooded with people trying to do that. We didn't put language in there that addresses that. We made this effective for basically be new custody orders, quote-unquote custody orders, shared parenting plans, effective January of 2012.
Okay.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. One last question. And I had to duck out a couple times, so forgive me if this has been covered. Is there any other evidence from other states who now have or have had the presumption that this bill would impose? Is there any evidence, or is there any? Are there any studies about how they've fared? Either way.
Representative Scott, information from other states that have done this or haven't done it?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to defer to Molly Olson on that one.
Ms. Olson?
Chair Westrom, thank you. I can give a brief explanation to that, but it does require probably more than is available right now. But what I can tell you is, at the Joint Physical Custody Study Group in fall of 2008, that was one of the objectives, is to study what was happening in all the other states. One of the complexities is, in the legal language, it varies from state to state so much what the labels mean, how they're used, and how that's put into the statute, that it becomes very difficult to compare one state to another. On the other hand, having been involved in the family law reform movement now for 12 years, I have become very aware of people in other states that are trying to accomplish some of these same things. And in that process, I have become aware that many, many states have tried to pursue this same type of thing of basically ensuring that both parents are involved in a child's life. And what we see has happened is the language has been so watered down through the legislative process, trying to appease every single little situation, that by the time the bills in other states who have tried this have become law, they're so watered down that they're virtually unenforceable. And in the other states where they've tried this, the court system has then nullified any attempts to do this by just, in their judicial orders, reverting back to the way they always did things.
Representative Simon.
I'm sorry, just one last follow-up on that one. Let me ask it a different way, because I asked you a broad question. I would just say, as an aside, if you have any studies or articles or data or anything, I think that would be useful for everyone on the committee, but let me ask it just a slightly different way. Is there a state that you could point to that you say, that's the model, we want to be that?
There is no state that has a model that we want to that we uphold as the star state. Now is an opportunity for Minnesota to be a leader, not a follower.
Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom. There, Representative Scott.
Coming from over here. One of the testifiers this evening informed me, and it was Terry, I can't remember, the gray-haired guy, he left. He informed me before he walked down here that in the state of Tennessee, they don't decide any custody matters in the courts. It's all done through mediation. So there's a whole different perspective on how custody is decided.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, one final question.
Yes, Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chair, has a fiscal note been requested on this bill?
Representative Scott?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Members, I want to thank you for your indulgence. To the audience, I want to thank you for coming. Hopefully tonight was a convenient time for several of you to be able to make it after work. I want to thank you for everybody's respect for everybody else's opinion. Sometimes these hearings aren't as civil, and I want to thank people for being civil in the Civil Law Committee and in expressing your views. As Representative Simon said, this is a tough issue. Many of you were maybe out of your comfort zone coming forward, and we hope you felt it was worthwhile. We want to thank you for participating in your democracy. Representative Scott, we will lay this bill over, and you've got lots of food for thought. As I've told some, I'd find getting this issue boiling and then let it simmer for a while, so we might need to put it on simmer and figure out some of these answers. So, Representative Scott, we'll lay it over House File 322, and members, we'll meet next Monday. The meeting is adjourned.